Members, the meeting will come to order. I apologize. I don't like to be late. Something came up, and I could not get down here. We are going to start this morning with Representative Erickson's bill first, because that bill is something we heard for 2 days. We are now today just going to hear what's in the bill one more time and then move the bill. Representative Erickson, House File 1814.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1814. I'm to be before the committee once again and recommended to pass and placed in the general register. And I have a delete all amendment, DE4.
Representative Erickson, have you worked on this bill to the satisfaction of some of the groups that were concerned about this bill?
Madam Chair and committee, I have done my best to try to listen to the concerns of not only members but colleges of education, the Board of Teaching, and others. So, members, I would like you to note that in line 11 of the delete all on page 1, I've added reading as a subject area field. That on line 22, this is now specifically for those who have had a minimum of 5 years of professional employment. So before one could consider using this pathway, practice in the profession would have to have occurred for 5 years. Something new on page 2 is that teachers currently teaching under a variance may use this program. It's permissive language, but there may be an opportunity to use this program to become certified in the content area in which the teacher is hired to teach. Line 17 on page 2, the requirement that the standards of effective practice for teacher be a part of the program. And that was something that was of concern to the Board of Teaching. Program delivery is a new subdivision, subdivision 4, beginning on line 20. And this makes the program delivery available to post-secondary institutions as well as district-created teacher academies, among other entities. And the reason I'm interested in teacher academies is that there is one that is starting in my area in St. Francis. I do not represent that area, but the teachers and the administrators are excited about probably an opportunity to be a part of a program like this. They're working on raising standards among their teachers, so that is very appealing to me, as is the Minneapolis Teacher Academy. Under the eligibility license, there are no changes except in line 32. The mentor would meet with the eligible licensed teacher at least once a week instead of the language before that said once every 2 weeks. And, Madam Chair, with that, I have an oral amendment on page 1, line 23. And this is just to clarify the wording.
Okay. We have not voted on your amendment yet.
No, Madam Chair. I'd like to make this oral amendment before we do so that it's totally in the correct order.
Can you do that?
Madam Chair, on line 23, delete the and insert A. And insert after
at
subject
line
area.
Line 23, which the?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, page 1, line 23, the first the.
Okay.
And insert A. After subject area, specifically the word area, insert related to the subject area. And Madam Chair, the reason, and I struggled over this language. Ms. Larson helped me, and I struggled with it for a couple of days. But what I want to accomplish here is that someone in a professional career, like an engineer, who may want to pursue a license in math, has not been working specifically in math. The profession has been engineering, and yet we know that engineers take many, many math courses. That's really the crux of engineering. So with that, Madam Chair, these are the changes, and the delete all amendment DE4 then is ready for presentation.
So you're incorporating this language into your delete everything amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, this is being incorporated.
I think we should then, did you have a question, Representative Carlson, before the vote? Representative Erickson moves the DE4 amendment to put the bill in the order in which she would like it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. We have the amendment passed and before us. And
Madam Chair, I have no testifiers today.
No, we are not allowing testimony today. We've spent plenty of time on this bill already, in my opinion. Representative Pawlowski.
Madam Chair, I was out in the hall discussing the delete everything. Was the motion to send this directly to the floor?
Correct.
Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, there was a discussion in higher education to hear the bill. Representative Stang, we had discussed this earlier in the week. Representative Stang had announced he wanted the bill in higher education because of the impact on the colleges of education.
Well, that's a finance committee. I guess it can go to higher ed. I don't know how you feel about that. And then to the floor?
Madam
Chair. He did not speak to me. Did he speak to you?
Yeah. His committee.
It still needs deadline, Mark.
It's fine. It's fine because it's a finance committee. Yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair, that is acceptable.
Okay. All right. Is there Representative Carlson?
Before it leaves, I had the same question as a member of that committee that Representative Pawlowski had, but I had a second question as well, and the comment was made that the author had worked with a variety of groups, and I was curious then if all of the interested parties have signed off on the language that's now in the bill, or does there remain opposition?
Madam Chair and
Representative
Carlson, no, there's been no signing on. No. These have just been email discussions.
Madam Chair, in terms of testimony, then the other day, the groups that would have had concerns continue to have concerns, I assume, from what your comment is.
I don't know. Which groups have you been able to, I guess, with all your changes, which groups have you been able to meet their concerns?
Well, Madam Chair, the opportunity for post-secondary institutions to participate was a concern, and I included that. And I've had no response otherwise.
Okay.
Well, Madam Charles Scott, the DRB is probably going to have a hearing then over in the higher ed committee, but... I would be interested in hearing from, prior to that hearing, the concerns that the various groups still have. Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erickson, first I'd like to commend you for the changes that you have made. I think they address many of the concerns that several of us had. Unfortunately, they don't address all of the concerns that I have, and so therefore I'm still not going to support the bill, but I'm also not going to belabor anyone by going through my reasons.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll start things up by saying ditto with Representative Erdahl, except for his last point.
Representative Groning, we would expect you to comment on that last
Madam
point.
Madam Chair, of course. My main concern, though, I'll just condense it down to my main concern, and besides the fact that we can't have testimony, this is a perennially a very controversial bill whenever we have anything to do with teacher licensure. So to not have testimony and expect us to sort it out when it's a totally new amendment and we don't even have the old one in front of us, I think is too much to ask at this point in the session. But my main concern beyond that is that that we still are going through the commissioner and not the Board of Teaching. The Board of Teaching is the broad-based citizen group that has the expertise in this area, and the fact that we're putting one more thing on the commissioner when the department is already cut to the bone, and then we just yesterday tried to give them one more assignment And Representative Olson had to ask for another staff position to do it. And so now to have this whole thing on the commissioner, I think, is a disservice to the department that should be helping with instruction, and also not the best place to do it, not where the expertise is, not where we expect the thorough going over and the process to make sure that that all of these instructions that the legislature has given for teacher licensure that are nothing but heightened with the federal involvement that would be met. So there's no way I could support this amendment.
Madam Chair, just to remind members, the Board of Teaching, school superintendents, post-secondary institutions will be a major part of this advisory board that designs the program. They will not be left out. And I have plural use of representative, so it is going to be more than one person from the Board of Teaching. I personally want a teacher, a practitioner, part of that, and hope that the commissioner will point that. School superintendents are persons who've come to me and said, even from Minnetonka, I can't find teachers in some of these areas. What am I going to do? And finally, post-secondary institutions are going to be at the table, and they're going to have an opportunity to take this program and do wonderful things with it, which is what I hope they do. But we can't have alternative if we're always status quo. There's no alternative, again, if it's status quo, and that's my object here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, I think, there's one more question. Representative Hyde-Kirkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will also comment. I do like some of the things that you've done with the bill, but I still have a very difficult time with this because my understanding, New Jersey, New York may have this program. But as far as results go, they are not anywhere near where Minnesota's at. And I happen to think that we have a very good program in place for training our teachers. Our teachers are the best in the nation. And I think this is kind of circumventing it, and I have a very difficult time of touching a very good program that's in place. It's very simple. Thank you.
Madam Chair, these are candidates. Thank you, Representative Sikora. These are candidates, Representative Hyde-Kirkin, who will have multiple degrees in some instances. The industry, for example, has changed considerably in the field of photography, in the field of imaging. And I know of at least one PhD who has worked for Kodak, who has multiple degrees, in fact, a PhD in chemistry, who is very excited about looking at an opportunity like this. Because she no longer has a job opportunity with Kodak because they have changed their industry. Why are we opposed to offering someone with all that content the chance to work with our students? This is about having, you know, teachers of excellence who come with the best content going through this program, which I know will be rigorous because I wouldn't offer this if it were not rigorous. And then ultimate is to have that opportunity for our children.
Madam Chair, to that point?
To that point, Representative Hyde-Kirkin, quickly. We are
Thank
not
you.
Going to spend more time on this.
Thank
bill.
You, Madam Chair. But I have known a lot of people with PhDs that could not get their message across, and that's part of teaching. It's not just content. It's delivery and being able to get your message across. Thank you.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just, given the importance of this issue, ask for a roll call on the vote.
Fine. Representative Latz. We expected that, Representative Dabney. Representative Latz, we already have the forms out.
Or maybe it's me. Is it me again?
Pardon?
Eakin. Eakin?
Oh. I did that yesterday. Oh, jeez. I'm sorry, Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, as far as the people with PhDs going wanting to make career changes suddenly and going into the teaching profession, I think it seems to me that most people, if they're doing well and have an advanced degree like a PhD and are doing well in the private sector and making a lot of money, and that it's unlikely that those people will probably choose to leave a high-paying career to go into the teaching profession, a job which entails a lot of work. and not a lot of compensation for it. My guess is it's going to end up being a lot of people who probably couldn't make it in the private sector who see it as a fallback position, and I don't think that's going to do anything to enhance our the quality of teaching in our schools. As a matter of fact, one of the concerns that I have about this is that it's going to actually depress salaries for teachers, and it's a way to circumvent the market, really, in my view. Instead of paying teachers what they're really worth, instead what you're going to do is you're just going to lower the qualifications and make it into a fallback position for those that couldn't make it in the private sector.
Representative Erickson, that was our last question. Would you like to respond?
No, Madam Chair. I think that we don't know a lot of what's being proposed here today, so I would like to move this bill and
to
recommend
higher ed.
It be passed
right.
And go to higher ed.
All right, we have a roll call requested, and we will begin.
Representative Sikora.
Yes.
Olson?
Yes.
Carlson?
No.
Anderson? Bernardi?
No.
Biernat? Burrell?
Yes.
Biskins?
Yes.
Dabney?
No.
Demmer?
Yes.
Eastland?
Yes.
Eakin?
No.
Erickson?
Yes.
Greiling? Heigerkin?
No.
Yaros?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Klinzing?
Yes.
Krinke? Latz?
No.
Mariani? Meslow?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Newman?
Yes.
Olson S?
Yes.
Pulowski?
No.
Segrin?
Yes.
Seifert?
Yes.
Slawik?
No.
Erdahl?
No.
Wardlow? Zellers.
Yes. Okay, the result being 16 ayes and 11 nays. The bill is passed and will go to higher ed. Yes.
Madam Chair, before you take up the next bill, I just wanted to mention that I brought donuts this morning for anyone that perhaps didn't notice them when they came in the door for the committee members and staff. By way of a little background, when I was chair, we used to do that very frequently. And then at the last meeting, we would take a vote in terms of...
Who brought the most?
No, well, not who brought the most, but we did have a lot of people bringing them. In terms of whose district had the best donut shop. And of course, as chair, I always won. But I would leave a bill or two pending just to make sure that.
And I do remember those days, and that was the most important vote that we had. I think the whole session, wasn't it? That donut bill.
At any rate, the donuts are there for anyone that would like one. And
Madam Chair,
I bought enough of them so that I want everybody to eat them, so that I don't have to go back on my weight gain program.
Don't worry, I bet they'll go. And thank you so much, Representative. Representative Segrin.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney is over there pointing to himself and his district and saying he has the best. So I am expecting that the next meeting we will be able to taste his donuts from his area so that we can get a comparison here.
Madam Chair, I do have to say the glazed
Representative
donuts
Dabney.
Paradise Bakery in South Minneapolis, have one of those, you'll never touch a Krispy Kreme again.
Is this on tape?
Those are challenging words, Representative Dabney, and we expect you to stand behind them.
Small local businesses.
Madam Chair, I believe I've been called out.
I believe you have.
You don't have to go buy any, Representative.
Next Tuesday, next Thursday, I think we'll see game on.
All right. This will keep us in donuts.
This will keep everybody showing up before the donuts are gone. All right, we are moving. We are moving back to the business at hand, which is
Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Johnson.
Madam Chair.
House File 20. I'm sorry, Representative.
I just have one comment. Is the legislature then liable if we get fat?
What's that? We will pass a bill against it, yes, against obesity among legislators. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a little less controversial than the great donut debate of this morning. But I would like to move that House File 2832 be passed and sent to the General Register.
All right, Representative Johnson, would you explain your bill, please?
Sure. In a nutshell, the bill requires that public and school libraries in Minnesota install pornography filtering software on their internet terminals in order to receive state funding. And I just want to share a couple of statistics with you and a couple facts with you before I tell you a little more about the bill. According to N2H2, which is one of the leading filtering companies in the country, as of September of 2003, there were 260 million pornographic web pages on the internet, and at that point they were growing at a rate of 28 million per month. So if that remained accurate, we're at well over 400 million web pages that are pornographic on the internet. The U.S. Customs Service a couple years ago estimated that there are over 100,000 child pornography sites on the internet. A study done by, I believe it was MSNBC, along with Google and some other large search engines, estimate that the daily number of pornography search engine requests is 68 million a day, which is about 25% of the search engine requests that that are submitted on a daily basis. And then a couple of facts about kids and pornography, which I think are a bit shocking. There's a study done by the Kaiser Family Foundation, which is widely cited in all of the research that I did, and they found that between kids between the ages of 15 and 17, 70% of those children say that they had accidentally viewed pornography while surfing the internet. That does not include the children who said that they had purposefully viewed pornography, but 70% said they had accidentally viewed pornography. And then the London School of Economics did a study in January of 2002 in which they found that 9 out of 10 kids between the ages of 8 and 16 had viewed pornography on the internet, most of them accidentally, but some of them intentionally. So the statistics are shocking, and they were surprising to me, even though I knew this was an issue. In 2001, as most of you know, there was a lawsuit by 12 librarians against the Minneapolis Downtown Library. Those librarians sued because the computer terminals in that library had become, as they said, a magnet for users hungry for pornographic images displaying virtually every kind of human sexual conduct. Their lawsuit also included allegations of men masturbating in the library while they looked at this pornography. There were 12 plaintiffs in that case, but there were actually 59 librarians at that library that signed a letter saying that they didn't feel their concerns were being addressed, and usually the response was intellectual freedom. The suit was settled last year for $435,000 and an agreement to change the internet usage policy. The stories in the newspaper at that time suggested that internet filters were a possibility, but my understanding is that the Minneapolis library system has decided not to install filters. There are still some Minneapolis librarians who don't believe enough is done in this area. I know that I had two that were going to come and testify in favor of this bill today, but they have decided that they would not do that in the end. I do have one librarian who is here with us today. So, Madam Chair, based upon these statistics, what was happening and may still be happening in the Minneapolis libraries and libraries all over the country like it, Congress, the federal Congress, passed the Children's Internet Protection Act in December of 2000, which essentially says that libraries will not receive certain federal funds unless they install pornography filters, which is about the same as what my bill says at the state level. That was challenged on constitutional grounds. The U.S. Supreme Court last year found that the statute is constitutional, so there's not a constitutional issue about this. And since then, and in some cases before then, most libraries in Minnesota, it appears, have installed filtering software. But there are still some that do not. And our largest library systems, in particular, are those that do not, including, I believe, both the Hennepin and Ramsey County systems, Minneapolis, and I think St. Paul libraries. This bill does the same thing as the federal bill. It essentially says that if a library, public or school library, wants to receive state dollars, they need to install some sort of filtering software that is intended to filter out obscene materials as defined under the law, child pornography as defined under the law, and for those terminals that children use, material that is harmful to minors under the law. There is a provision that also states that if an adult requests that the filtering software be disabled or turned off, that the library must do that. And that's what the Supreme Court suggested was necessary in order to make this constitutional. That is in the bill both for public libraries and school libraries. I will tell you now that I have to deal with the school library issue. It was just pointed out to me by the School Boards Association that that could cause the schools some problems because the definition of adult is 18 or older, and are they going to have to disable it for students who are 18? All I can say is I will deal with that before this gets to the floor, because that would be a potential problem. We may just have to take that portion out for schools. This bill is controversial, as you probably all know. The Library Association of Minnesota opposes this. I'm not sure that that's true of librarians necessarily, because I've talked to several who are very supportive of the bill and of filtering. Only one of them is fearless to be here enough today to testify to that fact, and I appreciate that. You'll hear from him in just a minute. Let me just try to address a couple of the issues that have come up in opposition to this bill. I assume you will hear them again later. Some of you have received emails from librarians. I have received emails from a couple of them based upon an email that came out from the Library Association asking them to email us. Two of the most common concerns, and I think they are legitimate concerns, are cost and the effectiveness of library filters. There is a cost, and I do not provide money because we don't have any in this bill. The cost, however, is very small, I think, in the grand scheme of things as to what filtering equipment costs, and I'll have somebody who is a technology expert be able to testify a bit more to that. But I think more importantly, most of the libraries in Minnesota have already done this. They've found a way to do it, both large and small libraries, without devastating themselves, without going through a great deal of pain, because they feel it's necessary to protect the children in their community. We just have a few libraries, especially the biggest libraries, that have determined that they don't want to do it. The other argument is that they're very ineffective. They both do not block out all pornography, and they also block out legitimate sites. And I will admit that filtering technology is not 100%, and it never will be. It can't be, because the Internet is changing, as we've seen, every day. But I think that the argument that they're not perfect and filters still let through a small number of pornographic sites, 1, 2, 4%, isn't very strong, because 1 or 2 or 4% of pornography getting through is much better than the 100% that's getting through now without filters. And the flip side of that is that library filters also filter out legitimate sites. Again, that does occasionally happen. I'll let both my testifiers talk to that more, but it doesn't happen nearly as often as what some people are suggesting. The advances in the last 2 or 3 years in this technology is amazing to me, and you'll hear about that. It certainly is much better than it's ever been before, and it's also much better than doing nothing at all, which is what some libraries are doing. Finally, I just want to read part of an email that I received in opposition from a librarian, not a librarian in my district, but a librarian from somewhere else in the state, who set forth the cost argument and the inefficiency argument or ineffectiveness argument. But she also went on to say at the end, libraries should not be filtered. Libraries are a free and safe place for people to go to express their individuality and their personal interests. Please do not support a bill which would restrict people's basic freedom of access to information. And members, I'll be honest with you, I don't get that. Our libraries are magnets for children. We want them to be magnets for our children, to be curious and to learn new things. And if somebody has arguments about cost or ineffectiveness, I can deal with that. I think we can respond to that. But if the bottom line is that we not only want our libraries to be magnets for children, but also a place for the self-expression of people who want to look at pornography in a public place surrounded by children, that makes no sense to me whatsoever. And honestly, I don't even know how to respond to that, other than I think I'm living on a different planet than those folks. So that's why I believe that this bill is very necessary. I think it's a good bill. I think it's a reasonable bill. And, Madam Chair, I would like to call on my witnesses to testify now. Maybe I'll ask Mr. Tom Ross to come up first.
Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi. I am Tom Ross. I am a school media specialist. I've been working in library media since 1979. I am currently employed with Robbinsdale Public Schools at Plymouth Middle School and have been teaching in central Minnesota previous to this last 3 years where we moved down to the Twin Cities. Okay.
Please proceed.
I have a couple of stories for you I'd like to share. First of all, I'd like to share Susan's story. She's a friend of mine who worked in a large high school library here in the Twin Cities. When she heard I was going to testify, she asked me to be sure to tell her story. She said students used to leave inappropriate sexually explicit pictures on screens in her media center with the intent of accosting her with type of information. She said it got to the point where she would dread going to work. It was very difficult for her. She was constantly having to deal with the discipline problems. This is a very liberal individual who would not normally, you would find, actually she was never in support of filtering material before she had to work with this on the internet. When her school, by government mandate, installed blocking software, for her, that all went away, she said, and work became a safe place once again. I worked in Aiken. We installed blocking software early by our school board's decree, and we worked hard at first with our acceptable use policy to try to provide an environment that was safe for our students, but unfortunately, we had so many violations of the acceptable use policy, there was a great deal of time and energy being spent on disciplining students and alienating parents because their students were being disciplined. After we installed the blocking and software, we rarely had to discipline students, probably 3-4 times a year, for violating the AUP. Usually a gentle reminder of students were attempting to bypass the blocking software was all that was necessary. Here at Robbinsdale Plymouth Middle School, using blocking software since I've been there, I probably have to actually discipline students on a formal level about 2 times a year. The typical example is the student that I worked with the other day who was trying to get into the top 100 sexy models video website and was unable to, and I just simply had to remind him that the little notice he had on his screen meant he was not to continue to try to bypass the software, and that brought it to a close. Didn't incur any angry parents or any frustrated people working in the media center of the school to deal with it. In essence, it has taken our job as media specialists and made it much simpler. We do not have to be cops. We can be teachers. And that is a great benefit to us. Because the House and Senate have provided the Electric Library of Minnesota, and because of the heavy redundancy of information, I rarely have to unblock any sites. It is probably 2 times a year that it's ever an issue. I have confidence that this is a system that is working. I might note that my students do attempt to bypass the system, probably 25 to 75 times a day, and we do have records as to that on our servers, on our server logs. And I suppose if they're trying to bypass it at our school with us present there, I suppose they're trying to do it elsewhere. But this is a good system that seems to be working in terms of relieving the stress from our staff and our students. And in conclusion, at our last district media specialist meeting in January, in fact, many media specialists there who were previously against blocking software We agreed that blocking software is working for us, and it has taken the pressure off of us as far as having to be the school's cops. Five media specialists specifically said they are very glad that we have blocking software in our district. They feel like they can teach again, and they don't have the pressure on them that they previously had.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ross. Do you want to bring up your other person also, and then we can question them both at the same time?
Madam Chair, Mr. John DeRocker, if he would come down. While he's coming down, let me just mention one thing. The reference to the swimsuit models, that would not be covered under here because I assume that doesn't probably fall under the legal definition of obscenity or material harmful to minors. The school has decided to go a bit further, which I think is fine, but that would not be required filtering under this bill.
Mr. DeRocker?
Yes. My name is John DeRocker. I'm the owner of Nexus Information Systems in Plymouth, Minnesota. I've actually been in the security business for approximately 7 years, been in business 18 years.
Welcome, sir. Please proceed.
Thank you. I want to take a brief moment here to kind of explain where content filtering has come in the past, probably 36 months. As most of you are aware, one of the biggest debates was either under-filtering or over-filtering. The example that we talk about all the time is an individual trying to go and search for breast cancer. Before, where you put in content that would not allow the individual to go to any particular site that had the word breast in it, that's where the technology was as of about 36 to 24 months ago. Since then, manufacturers have improved their content filtering and have incorporated groups in terms of no longer can you go to a group that has sexual nature or sports or shopping or gaming, things like that. But again, you still had the issue of overblocking or underblocking. Since then, in about the last 6 to 8 months, technology has changed even more advanced. and I'll show you one of the examples here. There are companies now that incorporate what's called web crawlers into their content filtering. And what that does is it takes away the underblocking and overblocking issues. For most of you that have been on the internet, when you go to a Google.com or a Yahoo.com, those search engines, when you put in your name, pulls up 50,000 sites. They've incorporated that technology into the content filtering now. What happens is when somebody does go and try to search the web for a pornographic site, the software now will go and validate the site for its content before providing the images back to the PC or the individual requesting it. How that's done is the software is stored in multiple, in this case 11 different locations, on servers that have about 20 to 40 million pornographic sites already in the database. That's how it's blocked. It's about 98% effective. They've even gone to the extreme of being able to throttle nudity on the display coming back. So the issue of swimsuits, when you go through there, you can throttle the nudity count back to only allowing 50% of a screenshot coming back that has nudity that can be seen. Something that has 90% or more is not allowed to come back. So that's really where technology has gone now. And I do agree, as of 24 months ago, the issue was, could a student or somebody in the library go to see breast cancer? If you had it blocked, you most likely were going to have to call somebody to unblock it. Now that issue has been taken away. Again, it is not 100%. Okay. The example I talked about today, there are two sites, for example. One is called Hope Family Physicians. Pure pornographic site. You would never believe that it would be. So where would you start to block that? You could not. It's one of those sites based on technology that if you keyed it in, you most likely would get the site back. Another one is Online Shipping Express. You would think it'd be a shipping company. Absolutely not. It is a 100% pornographic site. So that is where you need that extra line of protection of the throttling of the nudity, the checking of the URLs before somebody gets that information back. So that's where technology is. I'm going to show you a brief, I think it's 5 or 6 slides, just to show you the technology in terms of where you can start to block and what you cannot block based on an administrator or a librarian's access to it. Thank you. we represent probably about 40 or 50 different manufacturers across a very broad spectrum of security manufacturers. This happens to be one of the ones that has adopted the new technology in terms of nudity throttling, things like that. So there are various manufacturers out there. This is not intended to be specific just to this one, but I wanted to show you the technology. Again, this company claims itself almost as the Googleization of companies, because what they do is that search engine based. It is the next step of technology and content filtering. What they do is this company, their software happens, it analyzes these various different types of subjects within a web page before delivering the content back to any individual. OCR, full text, objects, logos, things like that. So there's a vast variety of things they do checking before that page comes back. The crawling, and use approximately 500 different crawlers now. Crawlers are nothing more than just search engines, Google, Yahoo, MSN.com, things like that that they use within their product. What they have here is this is a data center. There's 11 different data centers worldwide. They have approximately 11 servers that are sitting in here with 30 gigabytes per internet access and 20 terabytes of URLs. They are just URLs, this is not data. Yes. They host approximately 20 million URLs of interest. These are proactive. They have a team of people that go out and find these sites. Again, the Hope Family Physicians, who would ever think you'd go out and try to search for it? This is a team that this is all they do all day long. This is the core technologies that they look at. They look at the OCR text. They look at your text classifications. They look at, on the Adidas, the object recognition. If you didn't want to have the Playboy bunny show up on there, but it didn't have any pornographic site on it, this is going by the object recognition. These are subjects that your people can put in there. Face recognition, the pornography and nudity detection. This is the throttling of the amount of skin tone that comes back in content filtering now. Digital fingerprints, and then comparison and similarity and identity. Okay. These are some of the technologies that are built into these softwares nowadays. You can look at this. This is an average web page. If you look at the box, you can come down to facial recognition. These are the types of things, again, that they look at prior to somebody getting the web page distributed back to them. Okay. These are the 58 different categories. As you'll notice in the fourth column from the left to the right, coming down halfway, you'll see pornography and nudity. It's broken down into multiple categories now. It's where categories before used to be just pornography, yes or no. Now they break it out a little bit farther than that. Pornography, erotic sex, swimwear, lingerie. Again, we don't want to throttle something so somebody can go to sportsillustrated.com maybe to see the swimsuit edition. So you have the ability here to allow that to go through based on categories that you want. The way it works in a nutshell here is the PC or the terminal at the library, following the orange line, would go out to their hosted websites, see the URLs. It would be based on the limitations that somebody has put on here for what they can see. It comes back down the blue line back to the PC, based on the rules, comes through the red line at the stop and go light and says yes or no. If it's yes, it goes out the internet, comes back with the page. If no, it stops it and blocks it. Okay. So there's no requirement on the core site for a bunch of software to be loaded, a bunch of expense, a bunch of administration, things like that. It's all done off-site. This is kind of the different categories here, how somebody would set it up. You look at pornography, these are the generic core sites. From here, you drill into them. Again, look at the pornography one. You would check pornography. You might check pornography and erotic and sex, but you would uncheck swimwear and lingerie. This is where you get into the overprotecting and the underprotecting issues at hand here. Again, nothing is 100%, but why, if you block pornography, if that swimsuit edition was in there, this would allow it to come through. Okay? The whitelist. Any particular whitelist, what it dictates to is anybody that wants to go to a biology site, any education-based site. You have the ability to put these in here so that no matter what, they can never be blocked. It overrides any rules. So going to a breast cancer site, going to anything like that, this could be put in from anybody, the librarian. The blacklist, this is a big one that we see in corporate America a lot. This is the Kazaa.com, the people that are surfing movies, taking things down to the desktop, watching pornographic movies. Again, you never know where they're coming from, downloading multimedia. This is something you can put in and block if you want to. Okay. There's just so many different things you can put into the software now. And that's, in a nutshell, where the technology is.
Madam Chair, that concludes my testimony, so if people have questions or if you want to...
Are there questions for these witnesses? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, the testifier. First, I'm glad to hear about the improvements that have been made. I'm a teacher in my school doing research on the Civil War. I couldn't get it to come up because it had weapons in it, and weapons had been blocked. So I'm just making sure that now, if I want to do some research for the agriculture committee that I'm on, if I put in exotic animals, I'll get lions and tigers and bears, right?
I can address that. Yes.
Yes, Mr. DeRocker.
The ability now to throttle, and I use the word throttle just because I use the word metered is a term we use. If you put in Civil War and weapons now, since there are so many different categories there, you would be allowed to go to those sites. Absolutely.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. I'm sure much of the bill is devoted to schools, and I noted that the testimony by the Robbinsdale School District media person, most of the testimony was past tense. And the question I have is relative to an email that maybe all of us or some of us received, said that all school districts in Minnesota now have blocking or filtering, and that was going to be my second question, what the difference was between filtering and blocking, but that would be a question of the author. But can any of you tell me what the status is across the state relative to that email that I received, that all school districts are currently complying with what's in the law? I know you have a penalty provision that's new, but if everybody is doing it, why isn't the focus then on the other part of the bill, which are public libraries?
Madam Chair?
Representative Johnson.
Representative Carlson, what the law says right now is that schools and public libraries either have to install filtering or do something else that addresses the issue. And so it may be true that almost, if not all, the schools have filtering software in them. I think that most of them do. But to say that they're all meeting the requirements of law does not mean that they have filtering software. It may mean that they are training their librarians in monitoring themselves and checking on all the internet screens to make sure that no one is looking at inappropriate sites, which, for example, in the Hennepin County system, their system includes giving out information, I think very useful information, to patrons about the dangers and appropriate use of the internet, and then training their librarians to be kind of the cops of the internet. Which I don't understand why you'd want your employees to have to do that, but that they are complying probably with the law as it now states. I don't know if Tom, if you have more information about schools in general.
I am unaware
Mr.
of any
Ross.
Schools that... Excuse me. I'm
That's
sorry.
Okay.
I am unaware of any schools that do not have internet filtering software anymore. There may be a few out there, It is because of the issue of monitoring and the extensive amount of labor it took, and we use both an acceptable use policy and the filtering software hand in hand, and that is pretty much how it works across the board.
Representative Carlson.
By the way, just as an aside, this goes all the way back to at least as far back as when Charlie Weaver was in the legislature and had the first legislation, and that was passed in some form. I don't know to the number of times it's been amended, but it was my understanding, at any rate, and then that email confirmed it, that, and your testimony seemed to as well, that you were dealing with past tense, that school districts were filtering, is the way I understood it. Just to get an understanding of that, my second question is maybe of the author. What is the difference, then, between filtering, and then we've now added the language, or blocking? The testimony, again, seems to imply to me that it's the same thing, so why the fine-tuning of the language?
Sure.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. DeRocker can probably answer better than I can.
By definition, filtering, typically, it's missing one word, and it's content. So if you need to take the word filtering and label it as content filtering, then that would be where, it, by definition, it's exactly the same as blocking. Blocking typically is a proactive approach for web pages. Content filtering, in most cases, addresses web, but it also addresses email. Okay, so when you get into text blocking, where you don't want to have pornographic text, or in a lot of cases lawsuits where text is leaving your facility, confidential information, that is where the filtering subject comes in. So it's typically a content filtering is the same as web blocking, and filtering is typically relayed back to email.
So, Representative Carlson.
I'm sure then it's filtering or blocking. So I kind of understand what you're saying here. So if a school district is filtering and not necessarily blocking, if I understand your answer, they would still be in compliance because you've got OR in them. So we're really not changing any current policy with a school district then, assuming my earlier comments are all in compliance.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that is correct. And this, the language, the fine-tuning of the language comes from more from the Supreme Court case that said, and the federal law, which has been found to be constitutional, so we wanted to be a little more flexible there.
All right, we have two more questions, and then we'll go to the other testifiers. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, there's been some discussion regarding the issue of overprotection, underprotection, the ability with the software to limit the different categories where there would be excess. Under this bill, how and who makes the determination of the limitation of the different categories?
Madam Chair, Representative Newman, that would
be
made
Johnson.
Under the bill, that would be made at the library level, as it is now. I mean, for those schools or libraries that aren't filtering now, they are asking their librarians to make that determination on a case-by-case basis as to what is legal or illegal under the law. Now they would still make that determination based upon the filtering product that they buy and being able to check off what sorts of sites they're going to block and not block.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, the testifiers, if this document, if there would be a document on the Internet about this conversation that we're having today, the testimony, would it be filtered out? Would people have access to this testimony?
No problem.
Mr. Roth?
There's a couple of ways my students would have access to this information. They would, through the legislative information on the Internet. Later on, they would, in any reports that would appear in the Electronic Library of Minnesota, which none of that needs to be filtered, nor is it filtered in any way. And all of that is our sources that we can verify and support and identify as legitimate sources. And so that would be accessible in that way. And then the third way, probably most likely, is that they would go to the Minneapolis Star Tribune or some other newspaper or magazine, and they would find it straight up. It's not the type of content that would be filtered in any manner whatsoever.
Okay, that was our last two questions of these witnesses. And we will go on with the people that I assume are witnessing against this bill. Matt Anderson and Elaine Keefe, would you come down, please? Mm-hmm. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll actually turn it over to Ms. Keefe to begin the testimony.
All right, Ms. Keefe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Elaine Keefe, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Library Association. And to answer Representative Johnson's concern, we do represent librarians throughout the state. And, of course, there are a variety of opinions out there, but the vast majority of librarians do support the position that I'm about to articulate. We do oppose this bill. And I want to make it very clear that we don't view this as a debate about whether or not there should be pornography in the public library. We agree that library patrons certainly should be prevented from accessing obscene or pornographic material in the library. I think the issue is whether filtering technology is the only way to accomplish this. The choice is not between either filtering or allowing unrestricted access to obscene or pornographic material. Current law, as has been mentioned, requires public libraries to prevent library patrons from accessing obscene or pornographic material either through filtering or other effective methods. And many public libraries successfully comply with this and accomplish this by having very strict policies and by monitoring very carefully. The current law was passed 4 years ago, and we think it's working well. Whether or not to use filtering technology as part of complying with this law is something that we think should be a local decision made by local library boards. There are drawbacks to filters. Filters are still a rather crude tool, and studies have shown that they do frequently block legitimate material, and at the same time, they fail to block some of the most objectionable sites. And there's also a significant cost associated with this, and both with installing filters and also with having staff available to disable the filters each time an adult requests this be done. We also think that local library boards should be able to weigh the pros and cons of whether or not to use filters and to make the decision that is best for their library. We also have grave concerns about the severe financial penalty that's in this bill for libraries that choose not to use filters. Denying all state funds to a public library that doesn't filter strikes us as very heavy-handed. For the most part, this bill tracks pretty closely with the federal law, but this is a place where it departs in a major way. The federal law only prohibits libraries that do not filter from receiving funds that directly support Internet access. And that means that libraries that don't filter do not have access to federal E-rate discounts for their telecommunications costs, and it also means they can't use federal funds to purchase computers that are used to access the Internet. Beyond that, though, libraries that do not filter are able to access other federal funds. By contrast, this bill would deny all state funds to libraries that don't filter, and we think that's excessive. I want to point out also that under current state law, libraries that don't filter will already lose some state funding, and that's because in order to apply for regional library telecommunication aid, libraries have to file a federal E-rate application. So if they're not eligible for federal E-rates, they can't access state regional library telecommunication aid either. Now, it's true that, as was stated, most public libraries in Minnesota will install filters by the July 1st deadline that's been set by the federal government in order to remain eligible for both federal E-rate discounts and also for state regional library telecommunication aid. But there are a very small number of libraries that have decided not to install filters. And we have with us today representatives of both the Hennepin County and Ramsey County libraries, and they're going to talk about why they've decided to use other methods of preventing access to pornography in their libraries. If this bill were to pass, the financial consequences to MELSA, which is the regional library system in the metro area, could be disastrous. MELSA would be denied state aid for any of its member libraries that don't filter. And let me give you a few examples of the services that they provide with state aid. Delivery of materials between libraries, the summer reading program, shared technology, access to electronic databases that go beyond those provided by the ELM databases that you fund, and many other cooperative services that help libraries to stretch their dollars more efficiently. What possible good can come out of crippling MELSA? All of its member libraries would suffer. We have other witnesses, so I'm going to stop here, but we urge you not to pass this bill. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matt Anderson. I'm a trustee of the Ramsey County Library Board. We have 7 libraries serving suburban Ramsey County. Or 6 libraries with 1 under construction. We've had a policy on the Library Board of Trustees for several years to not install filters on our computers that have internet access. We made that decision initially several years ago. We readdress that decision every year. Our meetings are open to the public. We allow for public comment. We take into consideration improvements in technology, the needs of our customers, and quite frankly, costs. Each year we've made the decision that for our library, it is best each of the libraries that we have, that we are best served by not installing filtering software, not only because of some of the ineffectiveness of filtering and over-filtering that you've heard about today, but also because of cost. As you've struggled with budget cuts in recent years, so have libraries. Many of you have read about the difficult decisions that library boards have had to make between keeping facilities open, closing hours, reducing services. For us, the cost of filtering software literally would mean, in all practical purposes, the closing of the Arden Hills Library. Our budget is that thin. We have a bare-bones budget for that facility, trying to get us through this year in hopes that the economy turns around. An additional technology cost spread out across all these libraries, we won't be able to keep that facility open, and the people in that community and surrounding communities will not be served as well. So it's a very practical decision for us. It's in some ways, it's an economical decision, and there are certainly principles on each side of the decision as well, and I think it's easy for people to demagogue one side or the other is in terms of what this means. But for the library boards, we take our jobs very seriously. We are volunteers, and we are trying to fulfill the mission of the libraries in the best way that we can. Instead, what we've done is we've taken other steps to deter people from using computers in ways that are inappropriate. We've made all of our internet access computers centrally located in the library, where no one really has a sense of complete privacy, where people walking around behind them are sort of constantly monitoring them, and there is, for lack of a better term, peer pressure to not use the computers that way. In order to access the computer, you have to swipe your library card through a magnetic reader. And so customers, before they get on the internet, are reminded that they have a magnetic card with their personal information that's being swiped across a card reader, and what the consequences of that may be. And we've, as people have already mentioned, we've trained our librarians to monitor people's use and to feel empowered to make sure that the use is appropriate. As a result, over the years since we've had this policy, we have received extremely few complaints about incidents in the library. Even the complaints that we have received tend not to be regarding any specific incident, but rather about filtering in general. And therefore, our use of our resources has been effective. And as all of you look forward to your campaigns this fall, and you talk about efficient use of government funds and making government more effective and more efficient, think about the fact that we've saved those costs of technology costs that don't provide additional service, but would just be additional costs. Instead, we've saved that money to provide more access, to keep more libraries open, and yet the consequences have been the same. People are not going to our libraries and using the computers inappropriately. There is no evidence in Ramsey County that our libraries are becoming a bastion of pornography. You can ask, I welcome all of you to come down anytime you can. Come to the Roseville Library, come to the Shoreview Library, come to the White Bear Lake Library in Representative Meslow's district. These are safe, welcoming, warm places for children, so I encourage you not to support the bill.
Okay, folks, here is our situation. Representative Segrin has to be up before bonding today with all the education bonding pieces. So therefore, we have to get through those two bills. So the witnesses who are here, how many of you are able to come back this afternoon on this bill if there are questions for you? Okay, so at least a couple of you can. Could we go ahead, Ms. Charles and Ms. Moulton Jansen, very briefly? You know, whatever somebody else hasn't already said or something like that would be great.
Madam Chair, my name is Sharon Charles. I'm the Information Technology Services Division Manager for the Hennepin County Library, and I will very briefly address three topics. First, what the Hennepin County Library is successfully doing to comply with current state law. why we have not included filtering as part of the solution at this time, why the proposed legislation would block our ability to be more effective in complying with state laws regarding access to the Internet in the future. The Hennepin County Library is successfully complying with the current state laws. In Minnesota, libraries are required to restrict access by children 17 or younger to materials reasonably believed to be obscene, child pornography, or harmful to minors. Libraries are also required to restrict adult access to materials reasonably believed to be obscene or child pornography. The law states that libraries may use filtering or other effective methods. The Hennepin County Library takes these laws very seriously and has found that a combination of training, monitoring, and offering optional filtering is effective. We continue to monitor the success of our compliance and will improve our methods if they are found to be not effective. Specifically, the Hennepin County Library does the following. We use a proactive response focusing on annual staff training, including how to implement the Internet public use policy on the public floor. The training includes scripted scenarios, precisely helping staff to know exactly what to say in any particular situation, when to notify a supervisor, when to fill out an incident report, and when to call the police. The Internet public use policy and guideline is reviewed annually by our library board. The library also provides a rapid response team. The team provides support for staff on concerns over public access to the Internet. This includes problem solving for specific incidents or complaints, interruptions, interpretations of the Internet public use policy, and development of tools that help staff manage this service, such as this Internet survival kit. It has the actual text of the laws and scenarios and how to work with the public. We also provide a website catalog. These are sites selected by staff for guided Internet searching by subject. We offer filtered Internet search engines as an option for the public. And we provide informational handouts and other resources for the public. We have not used filtering at this time because of the added expense and complexity and because our current methods are successful. We felt it would not be a good use of tax dollars, given that we don't currently have a problem for filtering technology to solve. Finally, why the proposed legislation could block our ability to be more effective in complying with state and federal laws regarding access to the Internet in the future. The proposed legislation mandates a particular technology solution. Should a better solution emerge next month, we would be unable to use it, or if possible, would have to use it on top of the specific technology solution mandated in the legislation. The current law states that libraries may use filtering or other effective methods. I believe that the current law is a good law and will allow libraries to use the best possible solutions available at the time to achieve outcomes. Thank you for your time.
I thank you. And Ms. Moulton Jansen, we have a couple of minutes and then we will move on.
Madam Chair, I am Marlene Moulton Jansen. I'm the Executive Director of MELSA, which is the Metropolitan Library Service Agency. MELSA is the largest public library system in the state and serves the public libraries in the 7 counties and 2 cities of the metropolitan area. The state of Minnesota provides funds for public library services in this area through MELSA. As MELSA members, the 9 Metro Public Library systems offer cost-effective, seamless services to all of our residents. State funds are used to assist a variety of region-wide programs, including sharing materials, outreach to new Americans, access to a variety of electronic databases, and teen and children's summer programs. One of the services that we currently offer, telecommunication lines for Internet access, will be impacted by the Federal Children Internet Protection Act. All libraries in MELSA have previously used other effective means to protect against access to images that were obscene, contain child pornography, or are harmful to minors. The recent Supreme Court ruling means that in order to receive federal funding for Internet access, each community must decide whether its libraries will filter. To date, 4 of our member libraries have decided to filter Internet access in their libraries. One county, Ramsey, has decided to not install filtering software And four member libraries have not yet made a final decision. The rationale for these decisions balances cost considerations, evaluations of filtering technology and software, intellectual freedom concerns, and the effectiveness of current protective measures. The proposed legislation in front of you today would damage MALSA and the libraries that we serve.
Could you be a little closer to the microphone, please?
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I should explain.
You have a very soft voice.
I'm hearing impaired, and I don't know how loudly I'm speaking, so my apologies.
No problem.
The proposed legislation before you today could damage MALSA and the libraries we serve. It would go beyond the current federal guidelines, which limits the effect of filtering decisions to funding for Internet access. It could negatively impact all aspects of library services to taxpayers in the metropolitan area. Here's how. For example, if the largest counties should both decide to not filter, the combined population of suburban Ramsey and Hennepin County exceeds 1 million people. This bill could cut those taxpayers off from all of MALSA services. It would eliminate customers' access to both Elm and MALSA databases. It would eliminate their ability to request books from other libraries. And it would end their participation in a statewide children's summer library program. It would, in effect, maroon those libraries and the taxpayers and customers they serve. The remaining 1.7 million metro taxpayers would also lose. Library customers from across the metro area are heavy users of both Ramsey and Hennepin County. Metro area library users now enjoy excellent services with access to over 100 area libraries and their collections and services. Ramsey County libraries, though, represent one-third of those libraries. Removing two of the major libraries within our network would leave gaping holes. Not only would services be hit, funding for both MALSA and its member libraries would be hit hard. The funding formula for distribution of the state's public library system support has a component in it for service population. MALSA currently receives about $2.7 million for that basic system support. If you remove the populations of our two largest counties, it would slash our funding to $1.2 million. This would have a huge impact on customers across the metropolitan area. For instance, it would impact things like our summer library program. Statewide library users include over 200,000 children and their families throughout Minnesota who participate in the MALSA Coordinated Summer Library Program. Slicing the MALSA budget in half would end its ability to coordinate a program that helps children retain their reading skills over summer vacation.
Ms. Jansen, we have very limited time. Can you wrap it up, please?
This is but one example of the devastation that could occur to our network of collaboration and cooperation, damaging services to all metro libraries. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me, and thank you for listening to my concerns.
Thank you, and we do have people who wish to ask you questions, and we will hold those for this afternoon, and we will take up, hopefully get through Representative Segrin's two bills yet this morning. You needed to do that, right? We will just temporarily lay this bill over, bring it back up this afternoon. We are meeting again 15 minutes after session. So that should be right around 3:45 or something like that.
Madam Chair?
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, just a quick question on the bill that you just laid over with all of the discussion about fiscal. Was the motion that was before us to refer it to the finance?
Representative Johnson, what was your motion?
My motion was to send this to the General Registry.
To the General Registry? We may have to think about that. You may have to go to Ed Finance just because of all the financial issues. There is no there's no cost in this bill, I agree. Okay.
Sure, not to debate that. Maybe we can talk about it later. But
yeah, we're not going to talk about it now.
Provide that any bill that would cause a positive or a negative fiscal impact must go to a finance committee. And with the penalty provision in there, that could cause a negative impact. therefore would have to go to a finance committee.
Representative Segrin.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House Bill 2502.
Go ahead, Representative Segrin, and explain your bill, please.
Madam Chair,
Representative Segrin,
yes.
Is the bill, where is your bill going?
I think it's just going to... I think it can probably just go to the general register.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2502, I think, will only take about 5 minutes to do. All it allows is that a member from the mental health community be added to the members of the committee that is the Transition Interagency Committee for Youth with Disabilities that serves children grades 9 or the age equivalent and their families. Right now, there is no representative on that community or on that interagency committee, and we would like that member to be included. And members, if you would like a little bit more descriptor on that that agency, Ms. Aberholden, I'm sure, would be glad to give you that background.
Did you wish to testify in the bill, or are you just here to answer questions?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. We just support this bill. You know, children who have an emotional and behavioral disorder, generally we don't have high graduation rates for those students, so we just want to make sure that someone from the mental health community is part of that transition team to provide advice to make sure that we get these kids to graduate and transition smoothly from the children to the adult system.
All right. Are there any questions about this bill? All right, hearing none. All those in favor? Would you like to redo your motion, Representative? As I understand it, now you're going to the General Registry.
Okay. Yes, I would move that House File 2502 be passed and placed on the General Register.
All right, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Bill is passed. Now, 2503, Representative Segrin.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2503, I have a delete all, 2503-DE1. It's in your packet.
Representative Segrin, do you wish to move your amendment?
Yes, and I would like to.
Where did you want the bill?
To go to the General Register.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, would you like to?
The purpose of the delete all is to place it in a different portion of statute than it was in before. After the bill was introduced, there was conversation with the School Boards Association and others that this might be the more appropriate place to put it in this section versus the other one. This will be in the area that pertains to suspensions of students. Okay. And the way it would work is that after a student has had 10 cumulative days of suspension, that would then, the next time, the 11th suspension would trigger a convening of a meeting with the pupil and the pupil's parent or guardian. Before subsequently removing the pupil again, and from the school, and with the permission of the parent or guardian, arrange for a mental health screening for the pupil. The purpose of this meeting is to attempt to determine the pupil's need for assessment or other services, or whether the parent or guardian should have the pupil assessed are diagnosed to determine whether pupil needs treatment for a mental health disorder. Before the way the language read, too, there was some concern that automatically after that 10th suspension would obligate the school district to provide a mental health screening or trigger that, and it's not the case. It's to really to look at, all right, we've got a student that's been suspended a number of times. Sometimes, you know, the social worker, counselor, or the teacher will start to discover that, well, maybe this child is involved with drugs or gangs or alcohol, but there also could be an underlying issue of maybe a mental illness problem. And we've heard testimony before in this committee and in other committees about a lot of times people that have bipolar disorder or some underlying mental illness will turn to drugs to kind of medicate their feelings or their problem in their conflict that they're actually having because they have a mental illness instead of necessarily a drug problem. And so I think this is just one way of making sure that, you know, if you've got a child that is being suspended continually, he or she may have lots of problems. Mental illness may be something that you want to consider. So that's how we're presenting it, and it's just another a way of trying to make sure we cover all the issues that children are facing now today.
Representative Slawick.
Madam Chair, Representative Segrin, while I'm a supporter of mental health services for children, I wonder, is there a correlation between suspensions and mental health issues, or do we have any clear data that says kids that are being suspended have more mental health issues? Obviously, as you said, there's numerous things. It could be they don't have a way to get to school. It could be that the parents are around. It could be drugs. There could be all kinds of things. But is there any correlation specifically, or do we have any data on that?
Representative Segrin.
Madam Chair, Representative Slavik, I'll let Ms. Aberholden share a little information for you.
I'm sorry. Would you introduce yourself again, please?
Yes. Sue Aberholden, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. There have been some studies that have shown that children who have a mental health disorder, an emerging mental health disorder, actually have a lot of trouble in school because often their behaviors, things like acting out, aggression, kind of overall what I would consider, you know, high levels of crabbiness, you know, those types of things are actually symptoms of a mental illness, an emerging mental illness, and children are often suspended and disciplined for those things. So there is some data to show that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Slaway.
Ms. Aberholden, do you have any concrete statistics you could maybe either follow up with me, or can you give us any statistics?
Madam Chair, Representative, I can get those for you, yes. And, you know, I want to make it clear that the mental health screening tool is not an onerous document. I actually have one here today for you. As you can see, it's a one-page. Typically, screening tools take 10 to 15, sometimes a few more minutes than that, and I have a copy of the page but handed out. Just to show you, this is one that's being recommended by the Department of Human Services. You remember last year, they had legislation that allows them to do screenings of children who are in the child protection system and children who are in the juvenile justice system, knowing that those two situations in particular place children at risk for mental health disorder. It's a simple tool that can be filled out. There is even a version where parents can fill it out. If a child scores a 28 on this test with never being zero, sometimes being one and often being two, they score a 28, you probably should refer them to have some type of an assessment. So it's really a quick screen to say, could there be some other things going on here?
All right, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I look at current law and what this is adding into current law, I guess I don't see much of a change at all here. It's basically, to me, says you have to have the discussion with the parent when you're making a reasonable attempt. The bigger question I guess I have is, and with the permission of the parent or guardian, arrange for a mental health screening for the pupil at whose expense, I guess, is my question. Mm-hmm. The bill doesn't talk about who would pay for that, and so I'm not sure what the implication of who would pay for that is.
Representative Segrin.
Madam Chair, there's a number of ways that it can be paid for. The parent can be required to pay for it if they have private insurance. Sometimes schools will do it, but it can be a combination of different decisions.
Would this fall under special ed expenses for which this district would be reimbursed?
I don't think so, no.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may, members of the committee.
Ms. Aberholdy.
Some school districts already conduct a mental health screening with children because they have those same types of concerns, thinking there might be something underlying and behind the behavior. And so what we didn't want to do is prevent those school districts that are already doing this from not doing it. A social worker or the principal could recommend to the parents that they go visit the pediatrician or family practitioner to have the screening done as well.
Okay, so essentially you recommend them to take them to their own doctor.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Segrin.
The parent is in control of the situation. The parent can say no.
Okay.
So it isn't a situation where we're saying that they have to have it because the school has, you know, even used this little checklist. It just, the parent is control, but it's raising the issue to the parent to say, look, you know, this child has really got some underlying problems here. We can't seem to keep him in school. He's not, you know, attending to his business, what he should be doing, and maybe this is one thing we should check out.
Representative Eastland, Representative Eastland, you're next.
Sorry. Madam Chair, I mentioned, or I talked with Representative Segrin, or asked her the question earlier, how many people did she think would fall into this category, and her students, she didn't think very many. I guess my question is, I mean, I appreciate the concern over this issue. Are we creating another classification of student here? I mean, are we creating an MHD student, or what? We have this tendency just to kind of stick people in a category and label. And I mean, it seems like we understand in education, I think, that the lives of kids are very complex. And there's so many things playing on kids at this stage in their life. And I guess my question is, doesn't this happen? I mean, when kids are constantly being assessed and looked at and categorized with learning disabilities and all those kind of things, it just seems like we just keep slicing the cake thinner and thinner and thinner and trying to put another category. I struggle with that approach, quite frankly. But you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair.
Representative Segrin.
Madam Chair and Representative Eastland, I respect your concerns also about how to, you know, make this a finer and finer definition or whatever. But I think in the area of mental illness, I think, you know, years ago when the special education law came out, it did include the students that had disabilities in this area, but it became the emotional behavioral disturbed kind of a thing. And I don't know, I'm putting words in the federal government's mouth, but I really do think that the intent was to look at children that had serious mental illness problems, and I think actually they've been ignored. I think we have kids that fall into, there's a small category of students. I don't think it's a broad category. But I think what happens is they exhibit behaviors that are labeled something maybe different than what they actually are. I mean, or they may get into drugs, but they have an underlying mental health problem. And so the drugs are there. We treat them for the drugs, but we never really treat them until years later. Because then finally we discover that they have been struggling with a mental illness for years. I don't think it's a lot of students, but I think it's at least trying to say we haven't been doing a very good job of this in our society as it is. It's a difficult area if you have a child, and a lot of parents don't recognize it right away either. I have a very dear friend whose young son was struggling and had aggressive behavior, not until he was 10 years old and he was seeing monsters and sleeping with a bat under his bed and then getting very aggressive and using that bat to chase her and slam the bat into walls, and that then there was finally a diagnosis made. But that child probably had some underlying problems for a long time. So it's, you know, parents, you know, do a lot of acceptance of behavior for, you know, before, and so do teachers, and so do all of us. And so I think it's just one way of saying, you know, let's raise this as one possibility after you have a repetition of suspensions and behavior that we may just not be suspecting this.
All right, Representative Carlson.
Yeah,
Madam Chair, I don't mind at all the direction the bill is going, because if the student needs help, I think there should be some way of plugging them into the system to do that. But I do have questions about how the costs would be handled. I guess mine are a follow-up of Representative Biskins. But in your answer to him, you said a variety of places could cover the cost. You said the parent insurance. You said sometimes the schools. Now, when we talk about mental health coverage, unfortunately, in my view at least, it's limited. Some insurance plans have it, some don't. If they do, it's usually limited to a few days if there happens to be hospitalization. And I think we're all generally aware of the fact that there are limitations and the debate that's going on relative to mental health in Washington, and what I think is sometimes now referred to as the Wellstone bill. But I raise that question because as I read the language, then it says a pupil assess or diagnose. As I would interpret that, assessment would be kind of a lower level. But if you move to the issue of diagnose, that's going to be a much higher level of service and more costly. And I really think this bill is one of those that probably should go to one of two committees, if not both, with the author's comments, you know, that sometimes the schools may pay. That raises the question of K-12 finance. If it's insurance or the parent, we're all aware that, unfortunately, there are Minnesotans without insurance who may not qualify for assistance, and then there are those that would qualify for assistance. And that would raise the question of the Health and Human Service Finance Committee in terms of what the potential impact would be. People. So I guess I would be interested in the comments by the author, both with your hat as the chair of K-12 Finance, as well as the author of the bill. And I, like I say, I have a tendency to be friendly toward the direction of it, but I think realistically we do have to talk about costs and behavior.
Representative Segrin.
Madam Chair, and Representative Carlson, the language talks about a meeting that would attempt to determine whether a parent or guardian should have the pupil assessed or diagnosed, assessed or diagnosed to determine. So it's really just a discussion about, you know, whether there's enough signals there for the parent or guardian to have. So it's very clear that the parent or guardian that would have that responsibility. As Ms. Aberholden said, some districts provide that already, so I'm assuming that if districts are doing that, they would go ahead and do that. There would be no cost. So if there was a parent or guardian who refused, and this is not about accessing ongoing mental health. This is just having someone have go to a pediatrician, to a doctor, to say, you know, does my child have some mental health problems here? Can you help us with that? And I think most insurance companies will, you know, if you're insured, will do that. If you're under medical assistance, the same thing would happen, that you would be able to at least access them for an initial screening or diagnosis of that. I would think that most insurance medical assistants are private, would be paying for that, because you're trying to figure out if your child is well or not.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, you by implication, you have that discussion, and the parent is there, and they say, yes, I want to have services provided to my child. I don't think the school district at that point is in a very strong position to say no if that's what the parent desires, and then that raises the question of who pays. I mean, if you're going to go through the assessment or the parental meeting and and all of that without some follow-through, I think raises some serious questions, and why not the services? And I also think there might be some issues, I'm not just sure how special ed services would come into a play like this as well. I mean, as we all know, are times when a student who has special ed services available to them can access education / health care. You know, there's that discussion about what's education, what's health care within the schools. But I'll just stop there if you have a response. But I think by implication, you're putting on the table that there should be some services.
Madam Chair, Ms. Aberholden would like to
respond. Ms. Aberholden.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Carlson. I think you need to, if you believe that mental health, mental illness is in fact a biological disorder of the brain, which we do, we don't expect the school districts to provide mental health treatment, just as we don't expect them to provide glasses after a vision screening or hearing aids after a hearing test. This is really a screen that we're asking them to do. And once you're in the meeting with the parent to talk about some of the issues that might be underlying the behavior, to say, you know, we're doing the screen on your child and we're having a lot of red flags come up, you really might want to go talk to your physician about this. To have the physician do the diagnostic assessment and to look at it more closely. The school district is in many ways not really qualified to provide a diagnosis because it's a medical issue. So we are not expecting the school district to do that. Many children who have a mental health diagnosis do not receive special education services. It really has to be so impacting their ability to succeed in school that then they would qualify based on their non-success in education to qualify for special ed. So just because a child has depression, just because a child has bipolar disorder does not mean that they get special education. In fact, many of them don't, because it does not impair their ability to succeed in school that greatly.
Yeah, I wasn't saying that.
Representative Carlson.
Because they might be diagnosed. I was just saying that some who may be diagnosed would have access to special ed services or already be receiving, and that would, at least for that category of students, raise that question. Like I say, I'm trying to be friendly toward the bill, but I think there are some discussions that should be dealt with.
To this point, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Segrin. And to that point, Representative Carlson and committee, it's possible, though, that the students would be placed on 504 planes, which we teachers are always in charge of.
All right. I don't think we really have time for more questions. I think a decision has to be made here. So we either send this bill to the floor or we send it to your committee, Representative Segrin. But we need to adopt your amendment first.
All right. I would move my DE1 amendment.
All right. DE1 is before us. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is passed. All right. Representative Segrin.
Madam Chair, I would move that this be put on the general register. I don't see that there is any need for this to go to education finance. I don't think that there are any financial implications to that. If the committee decides that they want to do that, I'll be glad to abide by their decision, but I do not see that this has any financial implications.
All right, at this point... Oh, is there a Nancy Schumacher here? I didn't notice that there wasn't somebody else who wanted to testify. Can you do that in a minute or so? All right. And then we will have a vote on the bill. I'm sorry, I just didn't see that.
That's fine.
That your name was here.
My name is Nancy Schumacher. I'm with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. First of all, I'd like to say I'm very pleased that the Delete All Amendment took place of the original language, because it didn't provide for any parental consent at all. But there are still two very bad components of the bill that I'd like to bring to your attention. The first deals with lines 13 through 16. I spoke at length last year with the man at Department of Human Services who actually kind of spearheaded the development of the screening tool. And the screening is something that's done at this level. Assessment is done you know, beyond the screening and diagnosis is much higher up. With the language here, it presumes that their screening is going to have a positive result and that assessment and diagnosis will occur. So in my estimation, the language on the last four lines of this bill aren't required at all. Secondly, with the screening, again, you've got confidentiality issues because it is in the area of medical treatment, so to speak. You've got data practices and HIPAA issues that need to be dealt with. Let's see. And I think that wording needs to clarify whether or not the schools are financially responsible for the screening. As a matter of fact, the language on lines 10 and 11 indicate that the school will arrange for the screening, which kind of presumes that the schools will be responsible for the expense. That's all I have.
Ms. Schumacher, it does say that the with the permission of the parent or guardian.
Yes, it does. But it also says that the school will arrange for the screening.
With permission they would arrange, without permission I guess they wouldn't, is the way I would read that.
Right, but it does say the school would arrange for, so with the parent's consent, the school would be making the arrangements for it, which would imply a financial burden there.
Do you have a response, Chair? Representative Segrin?
Madam Chair, I don't think the intent of the law is to say that then automatically, I think the intent of the law would say, all right, we think that there probably is a possibility you need to have an assessment done, and they would say, you know, here's your options. You can go to the pediatrician. If you have medical assistance, you can do that, and that would be the extent of it. It would not be for our, if the school, if they happen to have school professionals that do that service, they could say, yes, we have that service here in-house if you'd like for us to do that. And in that case, they've already, you know, expended the money to hire those kinds of people to do that kind of assessment. But I don't think it means that the school district is in any way liable for doing it. It's just to help them make sure that they understand where their sources are that they can go to get this kind of screening.
All right. Well, I think we have run out of time, and we are going to vote on this bill. And the motion at this time is to move it to the general registry. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill passes, and we'll go to the general registry. Members, we will be back this afternoon to finish up Representative Johnson's bill and to take up Representative Greiling's bill and the motion on Representative Erickson's bill from last year to move it to the move it back to the floor. Back to the floor. Back to the people. So we are in recess until 15 minutes after session. No, I think taxes is coming. order, no longer in recess, and we will take up where we left off with Representative Jeff Johnson's bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My testifiers are done. One of them is back, although Mr. DeRocker was not able to come back, and I know the librarians, at least some of them, are all back. I just had a couple of comments to make based upon some of the testimony, and then, Madam Chair, you probably want to allow questions. Issue that came up, or comment that came up, actually from a couple of the testifiers, and I have talked with them about this separately, is that based upon the policies that have been put in place in some of the libraries, that the problem is essentially solved, and that people aren't looking at pornography in the libraries. And I tell you what, I spend a lot of time at the both my Little Plymouth Library in the Hennepin County system and the large Ridgedale Library in the Hennepin County system, and they're great libraries with excellent librarians. And I truly believe that probably who's ever in charge of this thinks that they do have the problem solved, but I believe that's maybe a bit naive. We've seen the statistics, we've seen what has happened and may be happening in Minneapolis, and maybe more importantly, in my prep for this over the last several months, I've talked to a lot of teachers, I've talked to librarians, I've talked to a youth pastor who's a friend of mine, and I have shared this response that, you know, the problem is solved without filters in some of our larger libraries, and the response has been uniform from every single one of them, and that response is that they've laughed. And they said, we work with these kids every day. They look at this stuff, especially teenage boys. They want to see this stuff, they're curious, and they're going to look at it. And if they can't do it at home because there's parental involvement, and they can't do it at the school because it's filtered, they're going to find another place to do it. And the public library, if there are no filters, is certainly one of those options. And I think maybe even more importantly, Mr. Ross, the media specialist at a middle school, said that even though they have filters in a relatively small library, they're seeing kids 25 to 75 times a day attempting to get into pornographic sites. If they're doing it in a smaller library with filters, I have to believe that they're probably trying it in a larger library without filters as well. One other issue that came up was cost. There was talk about having to possibly either hire new staff or train staff in an ability to disable the filters. Disabling a filter is as simple as walking to the computer and typing in a code of 5 or 6 numbers of letters. So it's not a big deal. It's not time intensive at all. And there was also testimony about the cost of filtering software could actually require the closing of a library in Ramsey County. And that I don't quite understand that, because all of the technology folks that I've talked to have estimated that the cost for this technology is somewhere between probably the low 20s and the mid 40s dollars per terminal. And I know an estimate that I got from the Hennepin County system was that system-wide, the most this could possibly cost them would be $32,000 in the first year. Most of the technology folks I've spoken with, or in fact all of them, said that that's probably very high. But even so, it's a very, very small fraction of their overall budget. So I don't know that the cost is prohibitive. The cost of deciding not to filter if this bill passes could be prohibitive, but that's a choice the library board needs to make. That's all I have, Madam Chair. That's all I have.
All right, then, would the library opposition people please come forward, and I have a list of questions. I'm not sure if they're all for you, but I know some of them are. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. I have two questions. One, I think Representative Johnson mentioned, which is the cost, like in terms of budget. It's always helpful to know what percent of your budget might be impacted by complying with this. But then, that's a short answer. But my bigger question is, I'm just curious, the testimony, all the testimony that we heard this morning related to library patrons, and I know Ms. Keith used that word, and I think the rest of you referenced your entire testimony about library patrons. And I think the point is that this only deals with children up to age 18. So I was wondering if you'd missed that piece of the bill, because I think that's a very important piece here, is that we're talking about children under the age of 18, so the comments about all library patrons, I don't know, were exactly relevant.
Well, one of you please take
right.
that.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, Lane Keefe with the Minnesota Library Association. And just to let you know, the Ramsey County Library Director, Alice Jo Carlson, was kind enough to fill in for Matt Anderson, who couldn't return this afternoon. So I can't answer the questions about cost. I'm not a practicing librarian or library director. But in terms of, adults versus children, what the law actually says is that any computer that is available to children. And so unless we segregated and said, children can only use the computers in the children's room or something of that sort, I think that would be very difficult to do, particularly in a smaller library, to segregate adults and children. And so, the effect really is that all computers for public access would have to be equipped with this.
Representative Nelson.
Follow-up, please. Well, I guess I don't see that would be the case. If it's a big enough issue that you think there would be cost problems, or I think you could separate that if that were really the issue. I just find the testimony hard to get my hands around, because it's all about library patrons, and what we're really focusing in is on children, whether though, and I believe one of the testifiers talked about how you have to swipe your card, and I've actually seen those internet screens and stations at the libraries where you do have to swipe your card. So I think the technology does exist if it were really important to differentiate. And then my other question was, again, on cost, maybe somebody could answer that, what percent of budget would be impacted, and specifically on computers that would be accessed by children. So the part I want to know on cost is about the computers that this bill is dealing with, which are computers used by children.
Which of you wants to take that? Okay, go ahead. Introduce yourself, please, for the record.
I'm Alice Jo Carlson, Ramsey County Library Director. I think the biggest issue in a public library is that the computers are open to anyone who wants to use them, and being able to differentiate between kids using a terminal and adults using a terminal is very difficult. All of our internet terminals at our Roseville Library, we do have a children's area where we do have several terminals that can only be used by children, and they are pointed all towards child-friendly sites. And in fact, if an adult is seen using a terminal in the children's area without a child nearby, who's obviously not the parent of a child in the children's area, that person is asked to leave that area and go and use a terminal in the main part of the library. It would be difficult for libraries to set up terminals that would only be used by children, particularly since some of our libraries only have four terminals in them. And if an adult came in and wasn't able to use a terminal because it was only designated for children, it would be very problematic.
Representative Nelson.
Well, I hate to belabor this point, but I'm missing something here. Why would an adult not be able to use a terminal that was in compliance with this legislation?
An adult could use
Ms. Carlson.
I'm sorry. No problem. An adult could use the terminal, but if all of our terminals were filtered, they would have to ask a librarian to turn off the filtering. That is a problem.
Well, one more follow-up. Why would they have to ask the librarian to turn off the filtering? I'm trying to get to the nut of the matter here. Why would they have to ask the librarian to turn off the filter?
If they were trying to reach
Ms.
something...
Ms. Carlson.
Sorry. If they were trying to reach something that they were not able to because the filtering was turned on.
Well...
Ms. Nelson.
Madam Chair, I think we're talking about...
Ms. Nelson.
Thank you. I think we're talking about pornography here. So you're saying that we would be denying adults the opportunity to view pornography, and that's why we shouldn't have this protection on terminals for children?
No, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Ms. Carlson.
I'm not saying that at all. Librarians feel very strongly that we do not want pornography in the library. That's not it. That's not the issue at all. The filtering software is not perfect, and it will still block some information. And if the customer cannot get to the information that they want to get to because of the filtering software, they will have to come and ask a librarian to turn it off. It would be problematic at our larger libraries because a librarian would have to be the person to go and enter the password or whatever is required. At our Roseville library, we have had to set up a system whereby people have to wait to speak to a reference librarian because it's so busy. So if you were at a computer terminal, couldn't get to the site you wanted to, you would have to leave your computer, which then, of course, would be taken over by someone else because there's always a waiting line, get into line to get a librarian to turn off the filtering, go back to your computer, find that it has been used by someone else, and then you have to get back in line. It would cause a huge problem for our customers.
Representative Biskins, well, to that point.
Yeah, absolutely, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, if the testifier can then explain, if trying to get in a librarian to turn off the filter is so problematic, how can librarians then claim that we have adequate supervision of the kids at the computers? I don't understand. How are we supervising the computers at all, absent filters, if it is so difficult to get a librarian's attention to turn the filters off? I don't understand how we're supervising at all at this point. And I hope the inference is that we're not, and we don't believe we have to.
Ms. Carlson.
No, that is not true at all. Our librarians, whether they are helping a customer or not, are always out on the floor, on the public floor. And as they are walking past, our internet terminals are pretty much all clustered in one area, right in proximity to the reference desk so that they can be easily monitored. And as a librarian is taking a customer out to find the answer to their question, they almost have to walk by the terminals, and they pay very close attention to what is going on in that area.
To that point?
Yes.
All right. Representative Newman.
Madam Chair, to any one of the three witnesses, the language that I see in the proposed statute says that at the request of an adult conducting a bona fide research or pursuing another lawful purpose, a public library must unblock the filtered sites without significant delay and without requiring the adult to explain the request. Is it your position that you are opposed to that language?
Ms. Carlson. Or did somebody else wish to answer? Ms. O'Keefe?
Madam Chair, Ms. Carlson is thinking. No, we are certainly not opposed to that language. For one thing, that is a requirement of the federal law and also of the Supreme Court. Actually, the federal law originally said that the public library may unblock the access, but the Supreme Court decision made it clear that that essentially was a must, and that was the reason why they were able to rule the federal law constitutional, is because that option existed. No, I think our point is that this adds another burden to libraries, and we would prefer not to be required by state law to filter, but to be able to deal with preventing access to obscene and pornographic material in the library via our policies and our strict monitoring and so forth, which we think has been quite successful. If we have to filter, then certainly, adults should have this right, but it will place an additional burden on library staff.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To rephrase the question, does the Minnesota Library Association, the Ramsey County Library, the Hennepin County Library, and the Metro Library Service Agency all take the position that the language that I just read to you is an unreasonable request in protecting our children against pornography.
Ms. Carlson? Ms. Charles? I'm sorry, Ms. Jansen, right?
I'm Marlene Moulton Jansen. I'm the executive director of MALFA, and I'm operating under a handicap here, and I'll hope that you'll forgive me. I've been going up and down because I've been trying to lip read you, and I'm not sure that I heard you correctly, so I'm going to ask Elaine to write down what you just said. But I think it's important to know that the MALFA, the Metropolitan Library Service Agency, Board of Trustees, and we're governed by a commissioner from each of our counties, a representative of Minneapolis and St. Paul, have not taken an issue on this bill. This is, I'm providing the information on the potential impact of this bill, but I need to be very careful to say that the board has not taken a position. This is, filtering is a local control issue. It's something that each of our member libraries need to make a decision for their communities per se. So I need to put that out on the table.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Newman, Representative Newman.
Jeez. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will rephrase the question, and I will look at the witness so she can lip read me. And my question is whether the Minnesota Library Association, the Ramsey County Library, the Hennepin County Library, and the Metro Library Service Agency are taking the position that the provision of the bill that I just read is an unreasonable burden on the libraries in protecting our children against access to pornography.
Ms. Carlson?
Again, what I want to say is we do not want children opposed to pornography. So, in answer to your question, we are not opposed to that language. I think that we have proven methods in place that take care of this issue today that have worked since the Ramsey County Library has had access to the Internet. We offer parents a card restriction so that if they would like their child to be restricted from any Internet access, they fill out a form and their child's card is not able to access the Internet. As Mr. Anderson explained this morning in our library system, he explained it a little differently than it actually works. When you want to use an Internet terminal, you have to be a registered library card holder in the Ramsey County Library System. When you get to a terminal, you need to put in your library card barcode. If a child has a restriction by a parent on their library card, they will not be able to access the Internet. They can go to a librarian and ask if that restriction can be lifted, and the librarian will not do it. It is up to the parent. And that is what we hope is happening, that parents are accompanying their children to the library and are monitoring their children's use of the Internet.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
This is for the Ramsey County Library. I think earlier in your testimony this morning, you were saying that Ramsey County has the technology or the ability technologically to know when a particular person is accessing the Internet. I just was wondering if you could tell me how many off-limit sites, pornographic sites have been hit, in the, let's say, the last month or year in the Ramsey County libraries.
Ms. Carlson?
I'm sorry, I believe that somewhere there was a miscommunication. Although
the library customer is required to put in their library card barcode in order to use the internet. We do not track sites that are hit. As soon as the computer is rebooted, the sites that have been used no longer exist.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So swiping the card in the card reader doesn't register sites. So you're, without the technology, you said that there is people that walk around invisibly or physically monitor. Is that correct?
Ms. Carlson.
Yes, we do have librarians in all of our locations, and they, part of their job is not only monitoring what is happening on the internet terminals, but monitoring what is happening within our buildings. The internet net is not the only danger in a public building. Because it's a public building, anyone can walk in, and we want our librarians to be aware of what is happening, no matter whether it's in the section where the internet terminals are located or whether it's in the farthest corner of the library where someone is simply studying.
Representative Anderson, one more follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. I don't talk that much.
You're right. You go
I'm
right
ahead. I'm not Representative Erdahl. It's late. It's been a long day. Sorry. I didn't know. I wasn't going to go there. Thank you, Madam Chair. And my final question is, could you tell me then, approximately in the last month in the Ramsey County Libraries, do you keep track of how many times that physical person has had to go to the computer terminal and tell somebody that what they're viewing is inappropriate?
Ms. Carlson.
It is not tracked formally. If there is an incident at any of our libraries, I am informed. An incident report is filled out. We also encourage our staff to call the police. To my knowledge, I have not had an incident report in the years that I have been the library director in the past 5 years.
All right, Representative Dimmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I do remember my question even.
Amazing.
But what I'm not certain about, I think is it Mr. Johnson, Matt Johnson? Am I right on that?
Anderson.
You know, Anderson, okay.
Wait, who's here?
He's not there.
He's not here, so we have instead Ms. Carlson.
No. Tom Roth, maybe.
Oh, you mean Tom Ross from Plymouth Middle School?
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. And maybe anybody can answer the question, actually. Well, my question was, I think the testimony was that an Arden Hills library was going to have to close if this legislation was to pass. Am I correct on that?
That was the testimony.
And I guess my question is what's the anticipated cost of this software that would cause the library to actually physically close?
Ms. Carlson.
Over the past 2 years, the Ramsey County Library System has taken an 8.9% budget reduction. The Arden Hills Library was slated to close on January 1st this year due to those budget reductions. The library board decided that they would close the library. The county board, when our budget went to the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, decided to keep the library open but did not provide funding. In essence, we are running 6 libraries on a budget for 5. What Mr. Anderson was indicating is that our budget is so tight that there is not money for filtering software in the budget. And therefore, if we would have to go that route, we would have to cut library services.
Representative Dimmer.
Madam Chair, thank you. I guess my question was, how much would that filtering software cost?
Ms. Carlson.
For the Ramsey County Library System, I would say it would cost anywhere between $20,000 and $40,000.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson.
To that point, Madam Chair, to that point, can
Representative Eastland.
You just said a few minutes ago that if a younger person comes in there and they're not supposed to view pornography, that you're already filter.
No, I think she was saying been filtered. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, she said if parents have requested their child not view pornography, have filtered, but that's on their card, and when they swipe their card, then it's filtered.
Ms. Carlson.
In effect, the parent is exercising their responsibility in requesting this action. This is not an action taken by the library. It is an action taken by the parent.
But the point is the filter must already exist.
Ms. Carlson. You don't have to answer it if you don't have an answer. Representative Eastland, did you wish to phrase your question in another way? All right, Representative Eakin, do you still have a question? Are you here yet?
Yep.
All right, Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if the whole idea of this disabling the filter couldn't be handled electronically when they swipe the card. If they're not 18 years old, it doesn't disable a filter. If they are 18 years old, it disables the filter every time. I think it doesn't need a comment. My question goes to Mr. Ross's testimony, and it's really not a question, it's a comment, but a very important one, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ross said that they have a way of tracking all the sites that each student would access, and that this was very inexpensive to do. And I just wanted to point out that sometimes we have to listen very carefully to testimony, because in civil law, on the CrimNet database, they said tracking what people access, what information, would be very expensive. And the two things just don't jive for me, Madam Chair, so I just wanted to thank Mr. Ross for helping me make a decision on a CrimNet bill in civil law, even though I'm in education policy.
Thank you for that, Representative Burnett. And Representative Seifert, did you have a question?
No, I just want a roll call.
Okay, there will be a roll call when it's time. I have no more questions for these witnesses. Representative Johnson, would you wish to come back up? Thank you very much, ladies, for coming back and being willing to answer questions. Representative Carlson.
Before you have the vote, I wanted to find out what the motion was, because this morning I had raised the question of cost. I think the discussion here in the last few minutes would indicate that whatever the cost may be, there should be a discussion.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll move to send it to K-12 Finance.
Yeah,
that's fine.
That's what you'd agree to this morning, so I just want to make sure that was the motion.
That's what I've written down here, but it's nice to hear the author say that. Are there any further questions? Representative, did you wish to testify? Okay.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I just want to make some comments. And I shared a little bit with Mr. Johnson, is on page 3, lines 12, beginning after adult, and then continuing on to page 13 after comma. Conducting bona fide research or pursuing another lawful purpose. For my own self, I'd like to suggest that that be deleted, even though that is based upon the federal law. But by using that standard, and as you may remember in testimony, federal law was very specific for funding for certain kinds of things. Now putting this into a state funding kind of thing, and which is broad, when you talk about MELSA, and you talk about ELL, I think it is, I'll give you an example. In St. Paul, I go to the internet. I then go to the Minneapolis catalog. I go to the Ramsey County catalog. I go through all these things through MELSA and the Minnesota Electric Library thing or whatever, which is state-funded. And they give credit that it's state-funded, too. So people know when they're using it, their taxpayers' money is being used wisely. There's a little thing on there. I think that what this language will do will set up more of situations between patrons and librarians. Are you doing bona fide research? Are you pursuing another lawful purpose? That's the concerns I have. I also spoke with Mr. Johnson about some, maybe some language issues, but that's something for another that can be dealt with as the time goes on. Secondly, I want to let you know, just as it did on the federal issue, this could be a state constitutional issue too. So depending on how broad you go and the kind of words you use, you must remember, as you all know, and I know that just by being around here you learn these kinds of things, when you use federal funds, you go through a federal process, and that's what the library case was about. But now dealing with state funds, you bring up our own state constitution and how that's been interpreted over the years in specific case law. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just share those concerns. Thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Just don't run away yet. Would you say again, what were the words that concern you? Was it that whole section, you know, lines 11 to 15, or was it just the first phrase?
Where it says, after adult, conducting bona fide research or pursuing another lawful purpose. Because already you cannot look under obscene or child pornography. That's illegal. That's unconstitutionally, that is not constitutionally protected. And so I think you get into judgment issues. As you can see, I didn't talk about it in the school setting because there's a little bit more control. And as you know, I do believe that there's more control for parents and schools for kids under, except with some exceptions, but at least that's why I'm just focusing on in general libraries, particularly when the filter's off.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Neumeister. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, just in response to that, and I, as always, appreciate your input because you know what you're talking about. What we did here is we tried to track the federal law and the Supreme Court case that found the federal law constitutional, and that's where that essentially where that language came from. So I would be uncomfortable changing that because we may be creating a new issue.
All right, Representative Greiling. Last question on this bill.
Mine is not a question, it's a comment about how I'm going to vote. So you want questions first?
If you don't have a question, Representative Greiling, we'll see how you vote shortly, I believe.
Well, okay. Sure, I'd like to make a comment.
Fine, make a comment, Representative Greiling. You are the one person on this committee that always gets to make a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. I just wanted to say that that I do not plan to vote for this bill, and it's not because I support pornography and our children having access to it. In fact, if Representative Johnson, if you could figure out how to get pornography off of my office computer, I might be voting for this bill. But the fact that all that gets through and we have filters and so forth, you know, makes me suspect about filters working. And I would hate to think that we would be so short-staffed in our libraries that we wouldn't have human bodies out there with our children using computers as well. And I worry about this unfunded mandate having that unintended consequence. And I also live near Arden Hills, and I know how desperately that community wants to keep that library. So if you had some money towards this, I still would be, you know, worried about it working with the state of the filters, but I would think much more kindly of it without it being an unfunded mandate as it is. I think that the main thing is that we fund our libraries, that we have human contact out there working with our children and not just having them relying on imperfect filtering. And that's the fact that this has been dealt with our local library boards, that they care a lot about and feel strongly that children not be subjected to pornography. I have to question what we're this bill is comes forward almost every other year. We've dealt with it at the federal level. But now that we have a roll call vote, it has to make, I can kind of figure out why we have it before us again.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. Representative Johnson, do you have any final comments before the vote?
Just one comment. Most of the libraries in the states have shown that they can both filter and have the human contact in the library. It's just, frankly, a handful of large holdouts that have chosen not to do it. I think that this is a reasonable protection for our kids. I don't think it's nearly as expensive as what some might lead you to believe, at least based upon all of the technology folks that I've talked to, and I think it would be a positive thing for us to do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 2832 be recommended to pass and move to Education Finance. Would you please take the roll?
Representative Sikora?
Yes.
Olson? Mark?
Yes.
Carlson?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Bernardi?
No.
Biernat?
No.
Burrell?
Yes.
Biskins?
Yes.
Dabney?
No.
Demmer? Eastland?
Yes.
Eakin?
Yes.
Erickson?
Yes.
Greiling?
No.
Heigerken? Yaros? Johnson?
Yes.
Klinzing?
Yes.
Krinke? Latz? Mariani?
No.
Meslow?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Newman?
Yes.
Olson S?
Yes.
Pulowski? Segrin?
Yes.
Seifert?
Yes.
Slawik?
Yes.
Erdahl?
Yes.
Wardlow?
Yes.
Zellers?
Yes.
Okay, the vote being 21-5, the bill has passed.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson, would you please come back to the table with your House File 580? And members, this is a bill that we debated at great length last year. It was passed to the floor, and then it was put into the omnibus bill. And at the time of the conference committee, it was not accepted, and therefore the bill was sent back to our committee. I'm proposing we just send it back to the floor, where it came from, and where it will have a straight up or down vote, if so determined. Representative Erickson, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 580 to recommended to pass and to be put on the general register. Madam Chair, I really don't have any additional comments from last year. This is taking nothing away from present law. It is an addition that I think is going to be very helpful to teachers in that they can now reexamine the curriculum they have used, check to see what instruction they have used, and look at it to see if it specifically addresses risk avoidance.
All right. Seeing no other comments or questions, all those in favor of Representative.
In the past, this bill has gone to K-12 finance because of the cost factor of the curriculum.
Representative Carlson, there is not a cost factor. There's not a cost factor in this bill. There are a number of curriculums available, and at the department, I believe, there are curriculums available. And this is not creating a brand new thing. This is adding it to what is right now a course of instruction that includes all sorts of sex education.
Madam Chair, I understand that there are booklets and so on that have to be purchased. Then we had this discussion a year ago, and the agreement was, yes, that there were costs, and it went over to K-12 finance. Now, Ways and Means today, we had a constitutional amendment up, and the cost of that amendment is $2,000, and it was to come out of the Secretary of State's budget, but it still went to Ways and Means. There was a cost factor. So I really think it should go over to K-12 finance.
Well, it was on the floor as it sits right now. It was on the floor last year. Representative, do you believe it needs to go to finance, or do you want to refer it to finance? We can also refer it from finance to the floor.
Madam Chair, we'll just send it to the floor.
Pardon?
Madam Chair and committee, we'll send it to the general register.
All right. All those in
favor? Madam Chair, could we have a roll call?
Sure. Of course. What else do we do in this committee but roll calls? Okay. Not as much. We've called him twice. This is the second one. You're way ahead. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been a while since we talked about this, so just for my own recollection, do we, under current law, under current statute, do we have room and space for instruction of abstinence instruction in current law? I'm not sure I'm asking it right, but I guess what I'm just trying to figure out if this isn't like a major change, I'm just wondering why we're offering any legislation. Can we currently, under statute, have abstinence be taught as part of our efforts to provide information to students about this area of health care?
As far as I understand it, Representative, some schools already provide some abstinence education along with their sex education class. Some don't. This would say that it should be a part of it if they have sex education. Representative Erickson, do you wish to respond?
Madam Chair, under 121A.23, programs to prevent and reduce the risks of sexually transmitted infections and diseases, I believe it was Representative Abler who some years ago amended that section to read in point 2 under subdivision 1, a comprehensive, technically accurate, and updated curriculum that includes helping students to abstain from sexual activity until marriage. The intent of my bill is that we'll have clarification so that teachers are addressing somewhat this same topic, but from the perspective of risk avoidance.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I do feel strongly that there is a cost impact, so I would like to offer a
scientific and medical
substitute motion that the bill be referred to K-12 finance. It's my understanding that with a dual curriculum, there will in fact be cost to the school districts that have to purchase the additional materials. And to just kind of ignore these costs, I think, doesn't serve our school districts particularly well. And that's not a motion, by the way, Madam Chair, to the author that would in any way defeat the bill. Fits well within the timelines. It could be reported out as a separate bill. It could be added to the K-12 finance bill. There would be a variety of alternatives, but at least there would be the discussion of the cost factors.
Right, Chair. Representative Ed.
For as long as this bill is around, no one has ever indicated that there needs to be a fiscal note, so I don't see the need for it.
Madam Chair.
We have another person who asked to speak first, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. I guess my question is one of history. I was here last year. I don't remember us talking about a fiscal note or financial need, and I'm just wondering what's different about this bill today, why it should go to finance today, and it didn't last session.
Madam Chair,
Representative Carlson.
I don't recall the outcome, but my recollection could be a little faulty at this point a year later, but I think I made a very similar motion last year, the same motion, and I don't recall whether it prevailed or not. If I didn't make the motion, we had the discussion. I was part of that. I don't know if other folks remember.
Representative Nelson.
I'm told by our staff that that's correct. But
okay.
Did it pass or did I just simply make the motion? It failed, but I did make the motion, so we had the discussion.
Okay. Well, my question was going to be then, it failed or it already went to Ed Finance?
All right. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is perhaps to Representative Nelson. In the Senate last year, on testimony on the companion bill to this, the author there testified that this would require school districts to establish a parallel track where parents could choose one class established under current law where abstinence would be the focus, and in addition they would get medically accurate and scientifically accurate information, and a second track where it would be abstinence only. Obviously there is a cost to establishing a second track, parallel track. So I think the question is whether there will be a cost
experience by school districts on this is obviously yes. That's been the experience in Osseo and other school districts that have gone this direction.
Representative Dabney, this does not require a separate track, an additional class to be set up.
Madam
it just
Chair,
says this should be part of the course.
Madam Chair, that was the testimony by the Senate author last year.
Madam Chair, the Senate was amended. The Senate bill last year was amended.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, it did not match up with mine.
All right. Representative Carlson has a motion before us. This should go to Education Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. A motion does not prevail. All right. I think now the motion is to send it to the General Registry, correct?
Correct.
All those in favor, please indicate.
No, it's a roll call.
I'm sorry. It's a roll call. Another roll call. Where's Representative Eastland, who requested this roll call? Oh, no. I think he has a bill up. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that.
I didn't want to stay.
Request for roll call on the members.
You don't, I guess.
No donuts for him.
Right. When those wonderful donuts that Representative Dabney is bringing in come, he doesn't get one.
Let me take a note to that.
Okay, let's go.
Representative Sikora.
Yes.
Olson.
Yes.
Carlson.
No.
Anderson.
Yes.
Bernardi.
No.
Biernat.
No.
Burrell.
Yes.
Biskins.
Yes.
Dabney.
No.
Demmer? Eastland? Eakin?
Yes.
Erickson?
Yes.
Greiling?
No.
Heidrichen? Yaros? Johnson? Klinzing?
Yes.
Krinke? Latz? Mariani?
No.
Meslow?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Newman?
Yes.
Olson S.
Yes.
Pulowski. Segrin. Seifert.
Yes.
Slawick. Erdahl. Wardlow.
Yes.
Zellers.
Yes.
The vote being 15-6. The bill is passed once again and sent to the floor once again. All right, let's move on to our last bill of the day, Representative Greiling. And members, would you please watch on Monday, because we have not yet put out a calendar for Tuesday. We aren't quite sure what we will be hearing on Tuesday. We will not have a hearing tomorrow, so will you keep your eyes peeled so that you're aware of what we're doing on Tuesday?
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Just a personal note. Last week when we were debating the social studies curriculum from the commissioner, Representative Erickson asked about my history of contacts with the commissioner on that. And I just wanted to take a moment to assure the members of the affirmative nature of my answer, that she and I have appeared on television together. We're on the issue. We shared some radio time together. I've written a letter about at least one aspect of my concerns, as well as been published in the paper, and as well as, of course, taking the opportunity here in the public hearing. So I have, in fact, spent quite a bit of time with the commissioner sharing my concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill on the grading system, and I was approached by the student who's with me, Grant Johnson, from Burnsville High School, about this bill last fall. And he is an amazing student, and he's done all the work on this bill, and I'm going to turn this over to him, and I think we probably have a future legislator here, but I will help stand for questions if members have them when he gets done with his presentation. So I'll turn to Grant Johnson.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Members of the committee, as Representative Greiling said, I'm a senior at Burnsville High School, where I am captain of both the academic and science quiz bowl teams. I am also captain of the Burnsville Police Explorer Post number 170. for active and volunteering there. I'm also an officer of the Science Club, and I maintain a 3.6 GPA. But that 3.6 GPA, the way it's calculated, is why I'm in front of this committee today. I have a short PowerPoint here. House File 1738, may I stress, is just a study into a possible uniform grading policy for the state of Minnesota. Well, what goes into grades? On most student transcripts, what you get is a student's GPA and a student's class rank. How to grade students? Well, the new way is the weighted grades, which gives students a boost for taking honors in college-level classes, AP or IB. Typically, a full letter grade, you go from a B to an A for college level, and an increment for honors classes, a B to a B+. The unweighted 4.0 scale, A is a 4.0, B is 3.0, C 2.0, and so on and so forth. Well, what grading problems? School districts grade students in different ways. The old way is the unweighted 4.0 scale, and the new way is the weighted scale. And according to a 2000 study by the University of Maine, about half the high schools in the nation use weighted grades, and I would assume that is, no study's been done, but I would assume that is a similar rate for, if not more, for high schools in the state of Minnesota. College admissions. Conflicts arise in college admissions when admissions directors get applicants from students with weighted GPAs in class ranks and students with unweighted GPAs in class ranks. This is also the same for scholarship directors, too. They get conflicts. It's kind of comparable to the time in American history when, under the Articles of Confederation, each of the states had their own currency. They were trying to trade. They're trying to get stuff done. Nothing really happened, and that's the way it is right now. About half the schools use the 4.0, other schools just use the new one, and nothing's really getting done. The advisory board would make recommendations to the Commissioner of Education about developing and adopting in all Minnesota public schools a uniform grading scale consistent with state academic standards. Possible advisory board recommendations. You know, this is something that has happened. When South Carolina did something similar to this, they came up with a 100-point scale. States who have adopted it has also come up to, who have looked into the issue, have been Tennessee and Missouri. Well, what could come out of the advisory board? Only an unweighted GPA in class rank, only a weighted GPA in class rank, or a dual-track system of both unweighted and weighted GPA in class rank, or something completely different like a 100-point scale. There's problems with both weighted and unweighted grades. Problems with weighted grades, extremely large number of valedictorians and 4.0 students. Lakeville, they just switched to a weighted grade system this year with 1,963 students. Prior to switching, Lakeville's senior class graduated with 33 valedictorians, which is about the size of a class. The problems with unweighted grades, again, curriculum difficulties. Example from my high school. When students in AP American History were writing a four-page paper on Bacon's Rebellion at a college level, students in a regular U.S. history were being tested on location of all 50 states. On an underweighted scale, this would be considered the same, or A in both classes carries the same weight. This is a scale from, or a chart from Grade Inflation, the Current Fraud, and you can see as the higher the SAT score goes, the lower the student's GPA gets. This is what you typically find in an unweighted scale between 3.0 and 4.0. This is also the case at Burnsville High School, where I'm from. Conclusions from that study were students with higher SAT scores received lower GPAs in class ranks, and there was a direct correlation between the harder the academic classes a student takes and the higher the student's ACT and SAT scores are. Thus, schools with non-weighted grades in these schools, in a majority of these cases, class difficulty results in a lower GPA and class rank. Example, student in AP U.S. History receives a B, student in a regular U.S. History receives an A. The level of knowledge testing and homework assignments are not comparable. Weighted grade benefits increase college admissions. Students with weighted grades were chosen over students with non-weighted grades 73% of the time, according to a 2000 study by the University of Maine. Also from the University of Maine study, weighted grades ultimately have a large impact on a student's academic futures. problems with weighted grades. All schools do it differently. They grade them because of the lack of definitions on our classes, honors classes, and college-level classes. The curriculum guidelines in AP and IB classes are nationally defined and nationally standard. Also, problems come in, where does an A end and a B-plus begin? Teachers do it differently, schools do it differently, and that's the problems that come up with weighted grades. And again, from the House file, consistent, it would ask the advisory task force to develop consistent numerical breaks for letter grades, standards to define an honors course, appropriate weighting of courses, and courses and weightings to be used in calculating students' class rank. For future students, could enjoy the best of both worlds with a non-weighted and weighted class rank and GPA. Colleges and scholarships could compare apples to apples for Minnesota applicants. Increase in college admissions and scholarship offerings, excuse me, for Minnesota applicants. Summary, I would recommend, from my personal opinion, that the advisory board endorse a dual-track system of non-weighted and weighted class rank and GPA. Both scales, again, have their problems, but if you use both or come up with a system like South Carolina did with 100-point scale, that pretty much solves everything. Madam Chair, I open to questions.
Representative Greiling, did you actually move the bill?
Madam Chair, I was just thinking that I didn't. Thank you. I will move this bill to, I don't know if you want to send it to the floor or to the Finance Committee.
Actually, you're setting up a task force.
To the Finance Committee?
GovOps.
GovOps, okay.
I just realized you're setting up a task force here.
Okay.
So that has to go to GovOps. Okay.
All right.
All right, are there questions for either the author or Mr. Johnson? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Greiling, or the testifier. The question I had is, the task force is going to do... If I understand it, the task force is going to do two things. They're going to determine a cutoff for A, B, C, D, that sort of thing, percentage-wise. Is that correct? Is that the first thing? And then the second thing is also going to determine, you know, what is an A, you know, how much, on a, is it a 4-point scale or a 5-point scale? Or is that, am I correct in that? And then I have a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson. Yes, that's correct. And, you know, one of the things Mr. Johnson is stressing, and his interest, I think, is largely in the weighted grading. But I think this other part of the bill that you bring up is important as well. When I went to, and I know many of us went to, a conference that Representative Mariani invited us to, I forgot what the name of the conference was, but it was something about closing the achievement gap, and Commissioner Yecky was there, and she was talking about this problem, and that is that in addition to the achievement gap, we have the grade credentialing gap. And there are students from some schools, and often they are the ones where there are the achievement gaps, where students get to college or, you know, wherever they're going after high school, and they thought they had good grades. And then they get to the to comparing their grades with those kids who came from, you know, Wayzata or Minnetonka or Burnsville or something like that, and, you know, they find that their grades from an inner-city school may not have been as good as they thought, and they have to work harder. And so that's a problem as well. So this task force could address that as well. That's part of what we're asking for here. You're right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to comment on that, I mean, being a high school teacher, I know that Representative Carlson and Dabney and others on this committee, I mean, it's hard... I would just caution, I mean, the task force is going to have its work cut out for it, setting a statewide grade scale. I mean, we can't even do that in my department in Austin High School, determine a department grading scale. And it's going to be a word of caution that to get a task force to agree on what the statewide grading scale should be is going to be very difficult.
Representative Carlson.
Chair, I have a question or two, but I was just thinking sometimes I had trouble agreeing with myself. True. The question, however, I have is of Mr. Johnson. By the way, excellent presentation. I want to compliment you on that.
Thank you.
What I'm interested in is what your reaction would be, large school, small school. For example, we have students that come into the University of Minnesota Institute of Technology, and they're some of the best and the brightest from across the state and even nationally and internationally. But one of the problems is that the university has to offer for many of those students, or some of those students, what we would call generally lower level courses at the university simply because they come from small towns and so on, and they haven't had the opportunity to take advanced courses in math and science. It's the economies of scale. It's just the reality in an unfortunate situation. The university calls those courses remedial, and I've always been troubled by that because it's not the same remedial that we often talk about because they're, by and large, very successful students. It's just they haven't had the opportunity. So my question is how you would think that should be balanced, because they would be in a school where they would be taking a lot of regular history and math classes and maybe not even have opportunities for some. I know that when my daughter entered college, she attended a large Twin Cities school, and we had discussions very similar to what you brought forward, because she took all college prep. And a lot of those courses were challenging, and she had friends that took less challenging courses, and they would achieve a comparable or sometimes higher GPA. And, you know, her situation fit very well with some of what you were saying. But I would just be curious. I know the task force's goal is to sort some of these out, but being that you've done a lot of this research, how you would respond to those situations?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Considering it from the definition of a regular class to an advanced class to an AP or IB class, a college level class, or even PSEO. Considering rural, again, like you said, rural students may not have the opportunities to get into an AB or an IB course. And when I've talked to some rural people, I went to Boise State, where I talked to a lot of kids from Barnesville, where their school size was, or their graduating class was the size of my math class. And what they pretty much said is the students who do that would go on to PSEO. And then again, they got into problems because they were in a college-level course in college, and then when they wanted to go to a different college, you know, all those grading conflicts arose. But again, what the task force would sort out is where does an advanced class, AP, IB class, or regular class come in? My principal at Burnsville classified a ESL class as an advanced class, which they then published in the newspaper, touting that they were helping gifted and academic students, academically gifted students, when it was a ESL class, and, you know, conflicts arise there. But what my feeling, again, would be the students from the rural students who may have to, you know, enroll in the remedial courses, had hoped that they'd try to go to PSEO or at least find a way to challenge themselves from where they are. I mean, do you feel I answered your question?
Well, like I said, Madam Chair, I think that has to be sorted out.
Yep.
Representative Carlson.
I would hate to create a situation where simply because you happen to come from a small town, the school district just simply doesn't have the economies of scale where that can't be offered. And, there's some PSEO that is available. Well, let me put it this way. There are some parts of greater Minnesota where the opportunity to participate in a PSEO program is limited due to the geography. But there are some issues there. I'm an open access kind of person when you start talking about colleges and universities, and I wouldn't want someone to be in a competitive situation and lose out simply because they, unfortunately, were in a school setting where they just didn't have the options available to them.
Madam Chair, to that point.
Mr. Johnson.
you do get into benefits then, you know, as far as, you know, the small schools and the opportunities that aren't presented to them. And I feel that may be even prevalent in some of the urban areas, too. The White Conference, which Burnsville is a part of, Burnsville ranked at the bottom with 3 AP classes. That went all the way up to Chaska with 15 AP classes. Again, you know, that was a big disparity even there, and, you know, that's not to say that even some rural areas might not be able to get into AP or IB. And I would agree with you that it shouldn't penalize students just because their class didn't offer, or their school didn't offer AP or IB, and that's where I feel the 4.0 scale would be adequate in addressing as far as their grading needs. And, you know, then you get into their issue if they took all the highest level classes at their school, got a 4.0, ranked number one, where I took the highest level classes at my school, got a 3.6, and I'm ranked in the 20th percentile of my class because I have a class of 800 students, you know, then there's the drawbacks to the disparities in the class and the school size.
Mr. Johnson, just out of curiosity, you referenced your conference and that your school was at the bottom of your conference.
Yep.
With regards to grade point. Were some of the schools within your conference weighting grades? I mean, were they using the system that you're recommending?
Well, Madam Chair, what I was referencing was Burnsville and the Lake Conference did not weight grades and had 3 AP classes. That went all the way up to Chaska, which had 15 AP classes, did not weight classes. Eastview does it a very unique system. 196, Rosemont, Apple Valley, Eagan. Eastview and Rosemont, Apple Valley, and Eagan are also picking up on this, is that they use a honors class rank system only. And it doesn't hurt the students who take regular classes, but it helps the students, I'm not sure of the specifics, but this is what I've been informed, that it helps the students who do take honors level classes. A letter that was provided to me in my research from Eastview High School had an example where a student was in the 75th percentile of his class and jumped to the 91st percentile in his class when the system that Eastview uses was adopted. Other schools that weight, Bloomington Kennedy, Bloomington Jefferson within the Lake Conference, Eden Prairie held a public forum on it last month, and it appears that they're moving towards that. Lakeville just switched to that. That's all I know, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Mr. Johnson, are you mostly concerned about this because of a college entrance, or is something else driving this?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Well, two things. I feel first, you know, it is college admissions, and it is also, it's not going to benefit me, and I know that. And what I do hope is that there is a student who does come along, and hopefully any state in Minnesota or any school in Minnesota, that can advance where I might not have had the opportunity to in college admissions. A part of it is has to do with college admissions, but also I had some opportunity to go on national trips where I talked to students from South Carolina, and they said they had tremendous success with when they adopted theirs, how they felt that played out in their college admissions and scholarship offerings. And so it is what I feel about college admissions, but also I feel it is important if one school is going to wait that another school has it the same way.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Johnson, I was told that an applicant to college certainly has a responsibility, you know, to... exhibit himself or herself in the best way possible, but that colleges were actually looking at the courses you took more than they were looking at your GPA. Have you discovered that in your surveying or your interviewing?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Well, through the research that I presented, I have copies of the University of Maine study for you. They again said that they found this, she cited research in which she said that although college admission directors say, you know, GPA weighted, unweighted doesn't matter, the research of who is admitted and who does not reflects that students with weighted grades were admitted a good deal of the time. More than, yep. And also, my other thing, oh, Madam Chair, I forgot. Sorry, go ahead.
That's all right. Representative Erickson, are you finished?
Yeah.
Mr. Johnson, you know, I think some schools note that a student took an AP class even though they don't weight the grades. Would that have the same effect, do you think, as having a weighting system?
Madam Chair, actually what I do remember is I was going to say, in the course of researching Lakeville, when they went through it, they were told by some of the Ivy League schools that if we don't see a GPA over 4.0, that application has just been shelved. And other schools like the University of Virginia, which I'm an applicant to, they don't want to see your class rank or GPA. You just type in your course and you type in your letter grade. Georgetown, which I'm also an applicant to, kind of just said, we'll see what we can do. Johns Hopkins kind of said, well, we'll see what we can do, but we'll help you. So it does vary from as far as you go and stuff. But also I talked to the admissions director from St. John's, Ms. Miller, and what she said is they'll get students with highly inflated grades, and they know those students. But then they also get students from extremely depressed grades, like Burnsville High School, and they know that, and they try to adjust and wiggle their way through to help those students accordingly. So each school does it differently, you know, as far as colleges go, and it's amazing to see the difference, Madam Chair.
So the colleges catch on eventually as to how the high schools are doing
yep.
it. Okay. Representative Klinzing.
Thank you, Madam Chair, which kind of brings me to my question. When you just mentioned that the colleges adjust and change, I guess they really do look at the transcript, not just the GPA when considering admissions. And, I mean, I'm not sure if you looked at this, but colleges have very different ways of doing GPAs, and some of them define B pluses and A minuses differently, and some of them don't have B pluses and A minuses, and some do ABs, and whatever that is. I'd never heard of it until I went to college. And so it was my understanding going through the college application process way long time ago, but that they would look at the transcript and adjust the GPA onto almost their own GPA system at the college. And so I guess even if we do adopt a uniform grading system for our state, first of all, kids are going to be applying to states like Virginia, which may or may not, I mean, you're still in a pot of students or applicants that are coming from all over the United States that may not have adopted this uniform system, so it still may not address that problem. And secondly, you're probably applying to colleges all over the United States that all have different ways of picking students, be it GPA or not GPA, and they have different GPA systems. So I guess my question is, even with so much inconsistency amongst the colleges and all the different colleges the students from Minnesota will be applying to, does this really get at the heart of the concern?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Johnson.
Well, I feel that the underlying reason why colleges have to change the GPA and perhaps the class rank in the first place is for the lack of a uniform grading, is that they have to make their own, you know, okay, we'll decide what our uniform grading scale is, or they'll decide what it is, and then adjust the transcript, adjust the GPA accordingly. And what the House, the bill does, it does gather input from the representatives from colleges and stuff throughout the state. And your point is, yes, well received, that nationally it may hurt or help students, but I think it would be helpful, you know, instead of having 400 different scales for how many different high schools there are, that they knew that the state of Minnesota has one, and that maybe perhaps there's something on the transcript that noted, you know, this is the way we do it, hope you can figure it out. But I see what you mean.
Well, just quick,
Representative Klinzing?
Just quickly to that point, I actually was applying back when there were no weighted grades in the state, so I think that, and I thought that this problem existed even back then, not because of the high schools themselves, but the colleges have such different ways of looking at things. But really, thank you for bringing this forward. It's an interesting discussion to have.
Representative Nels, pardon me, Biskins.
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erickson got to one of the points that I was going to make, and that is what's the issue here, and I'm glad, thank you, Representative Erickson, for drawing that out, because that, you know, whether or not there is one or 31 valedictorians, that may concern some people, but that is an inter-district issue, all right, whereas this is a bigger solution to that and doesn't get at that at all. I guess we did draw out the fact that it is a college admissions issue, and we've had some discussion along that line also. I just want to make a comment along the lines of Representative Anderson's comments that it's tough enough to get a department to agree to a grading scale. I will take it one step further. I'm going to trump you, Representative Anderson. Both Representative Ward and myself are former mathematics teachers, and when you take a mathematics test and you have 5-point problems, I'll bet a dime to a donut out of 4 of those 5 problems that are each worth 5 points, we're going to have 2 different point values for the solution to the point. So we're talking about a pretty big issue here, and one where because of the complexity of it, this state has typically allowed local control, and Representative Greiling sitting to your left, I don't know if that's appropriately so or not, is a big, big fan of local control. And so, as Representative Quinzing said, it's an interesting discussion, but it's a pretty big issue. And so as we look at the wording of this bill, and as you move it forward, I hope you would consider on page 1, line, let's see, I got to figure out line 12, somewhere in there, where you asked this task force to make recommendations to the commissioner about developing and adopting, if you wouldn't consider adding the first decision about whether or not it's a good idea to develop and adopt, all right? Make that decision first, and then move on. If you decide yes, then what are those specific recommendations?
Madam Chair, can I?
Mr. Johnson.
I would agree that perhaps is a good idea. You know, it may not be. I feel it's probably not up to the members of this committee to make that decision, that it probably is up to the greater state of Minnesota to make that decision. But what I feel, why I would advocate state control versus local control is in a local control issue such as my school district in 191, where they have struggled with the issue for year after year after year after year after year, and they couldn't come up with an answer for it, where a district sent like Prior Lake has been waiting since 1981, I believe it was, that I read, that an applicant from Prior Lake to St. John's or Carleton or University of Virginia or Georgetown may be ahead of me in the way that school calculates that. May or may not, I might be helped, they might be at advantage, I might not be. But I feel that from the studies that I've gathered, that it definitely shows that students with weighted grades are placed at a benefit. And that's why I'd advocate a uniform scale, because I'm hurt when a student from a different school district has it just because their school district and their school board made the decision to do it.
All right, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Mr. Johnson, thank you for a very well-prepared testimony, and I understand your frustration. It is about college admissions, and I understand the frustration of applying where you have a maximum of what I understand is a 4.0, whereas some students can apply and they have maximums of greater than 4.0 because of the weighted system. But I just wanted to, I know you know this, but you know, all education is very valuable, whether you get a grade or not. And the fact is, I think you mentioned that it doesn't help you maybe taking these advanced courses, but it really does. It shows up in ACT scores, it shows up in SAT scores, and it shows up certainly in how well you will be prepared for college. And so I guess I would second Representative Biskin's maybe even an amendment that we study if this is a good idea to have a statewide policy. I don't know that it is, and let's just assume that it is. Does it really mean anything if we have a statewide policy when the policy, the grades that it's grading, the courses are so incredibly different? So I just would ask maybe an oral amendment to that point.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Johnson.
2 points. The reason, well, you know, like you said, you know, it is more than a grade. It is your education. And probably one of the most reasons that I've been very passionate about this is because at Burnsville High School, they decided it was all about the GPA and that you needed a 3.6 to get into National Honor Society. My sophomore year, I had a 3.51 because I did take the challenging courses. And all I had, and again, through the study, it did show that, you know, the higher your SAT and ACT scores, the lower your GPA was. And then what I would ask, you know, maybe that should be reflective of that. Colleges, you know, have, again, been more progressive in identifying that and, you know, adjusting accordingly. But also, you know, like you said, as far as developing a uniform scale for the level of difficulty for the classes, that's one of the things I hope the bill would do, and I believe it does say in the text, you know, that's what it has to identify, you know, what's an advanced class, what is an AP or an IB class, and what is an honors class. Because like I said, you know, the principal for my high school felt accordingly to label a course in the ESL section of the registration guide as an advanced class, and then toted it as a class that academically gifted students would take.
Representative Greiling.
Madam Chair, of course, Ms. Larson has come up with this oral amendment for us, so it is on line 12. Let's see if this meets with Representative Biskin's and Representative Nelson's interests. To make recommendations to the commissioner about, and then insert whether and how to, and then take off the ing from developing and adopting. So then it would say to make recommendations to the commissioner about whether and how to develop and adopt and so forth.
All right. Anybody wish to speak to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Next question was Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, you're doing an outstanding job. You do a lot better than I do up there presenting bills. But as you all can attest. I, being from Eagan, I taught there for 31 years. The issue of the two grading scales came up right after I retired. But I do see a need to at least examine this, and Representative Biskins brought that up. What I was going to talk about is, you know, I had kids who chose not to take advanced algebra because they knew they could get an A in regular algebra as opposed to advanced, and they might get a B+, and that would inflate their grade. Egan, when my son graduated, there were 4 valedictorians, but every single one of them was in all the AP classes. But when you said Georgetown, my ears picked up because my son graduated from Georgetown. And if I recall, they did ask if how many advanced placement courses he took, how many honors courses he took, because that had an impact on them. They also looked at the SAT scores, and they also looked at his essay. If the essay wasn't good, I don't think they even looked at the rest. And just some food for thought for you. And I have a name of someone that maybe could help you get a better interview at Georgetown if you want. Just trying to help out.
Do you wish to respond, Mr. Johnson?
Well,
I don't know if there was a question there or not.
Oh, I forgot my question.
It is late, and it's been a very long week.
Never mind. Good.
Go
now you see why I don't do well. Can I help you? I guess that's my question.
Right. Madam Chair, I'd be open to any help, especially, you know, getting in. But what I also would recognize is I do have 2 students who on a very short notice, some of my peers who came from Burnsville High School in support, they're over there, and they just came in support and like to wave to the committee.
Did you wish to testify or just watch? All right. Representative Bernardi. Next. You're next, Mr. Cross. Representative? Oh, she passed. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was just listening to Representative Wardlow talking about helping getting into institutions outside Minnesota. And as the proud Minnesotan that I am, is there anything we can do to convince him to choose a Minnesotan? We don't want to contribute Representative Wardlow to the brain drain.
Well, we did. We did hear him mention St. John's, and we know what a great football team they have after being on the floor today. And anybody can play. Are you a football player?
No, Madam Chair. I did take up a weightlifting course, though. Not to get an EZA, though. I'll put it that way. As far as the brain drain goes, I was accepted to St. John's and to the University of Minnesota Liberal Arts College. So I know at least I am going to some higher secondary education.
You're in Minnesota. That's good.
Hopefully, yeah.
All right. Representative Carlson, are you finished?
I just wanted to try to convince him to stay
here. Okay. Great. Okay, well, I don't see any more questions, and I think we've been here quite a while, and you might actually be able to go home for dinner. So let's just move this along. All those in favor of House File 1738, Representative Greiling, you are renewing your motion to move that this bill be recommended to pass and go to GovOps. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Bill passes. Congratulations, Mr. Johnson. You passed your first bill. Just a minute, you guys. We have minutes. Just a minute here. Please look at the minutes from Tuesday, the 9th. And Representative Newman moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. And the meeting is adjourned. We'll see you Tuesday. Have a great weekend.